guys, but man, it's time for them to get out of the way.
Get out of the way. We're number one.
That's right.
I'm Nikki Six.
James Michael here.
See you next week.
The Sideshow is now over. Go ahead. Stick a golden fork in it. We're done. Keep it on 101 The Riff to score your very own WRIF Man Guard, along with tickets to see the return of Ted Nugent, September 3rd at DTE. One lucky Riff winner will score the Ready to Rock package, including pavilion seats and parking for the Ted Nugent Show, plus Def Leppard Mayhem Festival and the Rob Zombie Slayer Show. Brought to you by your local Motor City Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Fiat Superstores and 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. Thank God it's freaking Friday. This Friday, starting at 11 a.m. with Ann Carlini. It's a badass Friday. Kid Rock tickets every hour until midnight for his first show, August 12th at Comerica Park. This badass Friday from 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Now.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. Jolene is off for the night, so it's just you and me, so call me. Usually I can always talk to her and sometimes to you, but hey, she ain't here, so come on down. 313-298-WRIF. And if you have one of those phones without the numbers, without the letters on it, it's 313-298-9743. And this is a phone-in talk show. Also, we take some emails from you at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Short emails are best if you'd like them read on the air. Although Jolene usually takes those. I got a lot of balls in the air, right? I wonder what you thought I was going to say. Anyway, as usual, Athena and Sarah will get your calls at 313-298-WRIF. We have a very active Facebook. If you'd like to check that out, become a friend, facebook.com/nightcall. And we will get a podcast of the show up by noon tomorrow, Monday. Lots going on. And of course, the big story. Let me see if I can put this together like this. Anger over job growth faltering badly, clouding hope for recovery, pours out online. No, actually, that's not it. Anger over Obama putting Medicare and Social Security on the table for compromise with the Republican pours out online. No, that's not it either. Well, let me try another one. Anger over U.S. wars leaving 225,000 dead and costing $4.4 trillion pours out online. No, that's not it. Oh, wait a minute. Here, I can read it a little clearer now. Anger over Casey Anthony verdict pours out online. That's what's really animating everyone, to the point where there is this absolutely horrible right-winger that's on one of these stations in Detroit when I come into work, and I always listen just to see what these guys are on about. And I thought, as usual, they would be talking about this budget compromise and the debt ceiling being raised and all that, and they're talking about the Casey Anthony verdict. I got to tell you, I paid so little attention to that that, it suggests perhaps a range of things, but the way that people hooked into it, it was really extraordinary. This news account here from the Associated Press says, for nearly 2 months, the murder trial of Casey Anthony was a living entity. I got to tell you, it was a living entity for me about 3 days before it finally got settled. It breathed daily across national television airwaves, then was reinforced nightly on cable TV programs that dissected every word uttered in the courtroom and fueled speculation onto her fate, on her fate, yeah. When Anthony was acquitted of murder and the death of her 2-year-old daughter, Kaylee, hundreds of thousands of people captivated by the case, certain of her guilt, poured their rage into postings on Facebook and microblogging site Twitter. Those and other social media sites that provided a platform and a large audience for a decibel level of vitriol seldom seen before. decibel level of vitriol seldom seen before. The threats, both veiled and blatant, were disturbing enough to make the judge hold off on releasing juror names and to make it all the more likely that Anthony will be secretly whisked away upon her release next week. Now, I mean, there is something so, I don't know, what so ultimately tragic about the death of a child, an innocent that hasn't even had the capacity to live life yet, to die in the way this little girl did. Apparently, and I don't know. I don't even want to talk about this. I don't want to talk about the case. I mean, it just, what I've heard, it seems like probably, you know what? I don't even want to go there. The point being is that there are so many things that our lives depend upon. Our own lives, the lives of our family, our parents, our children, wherever you're situated in life. And this is what really gets people going. I don't understand it. You know, there's tragedy here. But, you know, there's little girls that are killed frequently in this country. It's a very violent country. But there's something about this. Maybe because, this was the ultimate bad mother. I began to hear about stuff like this. She went to party and she got a tattoo and she had her hair up during the trial and she let it down after she was found not guilty and all that. Maybe that's what drove people crazy. Or maybe so many people are off work that they got too much time on their hands that they can watch television. But I don't know. I mean, if you were captivated by it, maybe you're thinking, hey, what's with this dude, man? I really thought it was important. It really moved me. How come he's dissonant? Tell me why you thought it was worthy of your engagement or your anger or what have you. I mean, there are so many miscarriages of justice. How many men recently have we realized have been on death row because of bad juries or police or prosecutorial misconduct and all that stuff? And I mean, on and on and on. So this had some unique qualities to it. But 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743, if you have a thought about all that. But these other stories are really important. And we're on a razor's edge right now where this is all going to go. I mean, part of it, I don't know if you've been catching all of this. I mean, this is not a show like most talk shows where almost all the listeners are news junkies. So they know all the participants, they know all the arguments. A lot of you, I think, come to this specifically because this is the point at which we can talk about this, and all the information isn't already in, at least in many. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to be insulting anybody. I mean, I'll tell you, oftentimes when I'm not doing this show, my information level sinks significantly. And there's so much that people often say to me, I have no idea who's telling the truth. I don't have any idea how to tell the truth. I feel that to some extent that I'm powerless. Both parties seem the same. Everybody's arguing. You know, you hear a lot of this kind of stuff, right? So, the details of this are such that in many ways, unless you're really paying very close attention, are a little hard to grasp. But this whole idea of the U.S. debt, this debt ceiling, what's going to happen with this the kind of money that this country spends and the amount of money it takes in, its wars, its tax cuts for the rich and all that, this is really important to all of you. I mean, it really is. I think great numbers of you know this, but if you don't see it as central, absolutely central to what your life chances are, and I don't care if you're 50 years old or 15 years old, because people of all ages listen to this show. If you're 15 or 20 or 30 or 40, what happens, perhaps even in the next few weeks, let alone in the next, next year and a half, may be central to whether this country is going to have a middle class, is going to have a well-waged working class, and is going to take care of its poor, or whether we are actually going to take this slide down to this third world status for about two-thirds of us. I mean, a third of us are always going to live real good. Remember I'm always saying that about the Guatemala model, and increasingly like the Mexican model as well. Well, here's what happened this week. Let's talk about what's happening with this recession that's over, right? And Todd and Gabe, I know you want to talk about Casey Anthony, but and we'll do that. Let me just set this up as well. I will do that. I will set this stuff up as well. So there was an expectation that the job market would grow, right? In other words, that more and more of us would get jobs rather than not very many people gain jobs and a lot of them are lost. So for the second consecutive month, employers added scarcely any jobs in June, startling evidence that the economic recovery is stumbling. I mean, I've heard people saying, and I don't mean to really bum a lot of you out, but if you're 50 or over, you're probably not going to work again. I'm not saying that's true. I'm saying that's what some people have been saying. Now, here's the problem. All levels of government shed workers, and hiring by companies continued to slow, resulting in a meager 18,000 new non-farm payroll jobs last month. The government also revised downward the number of jobs that they said that were created last month. Things like Michigan's once thriving movie business is now shrinking because Governor Snyder decided too much money was going out the door. And here, pardon me, is what still continues. Jobs in Mexico's manufacturing sector. We're talking about, you know, country right to the south of it, south of us. Jobs in Mexico's manufacturing sector increased 8.2% to 1.8 million as of January. So ours are shrinking. Our manufacturing jobs are shrinking, with this country still being deindustrialized. And at the same time, Mexico's is growing. So why is that? It's because they're paying people $2 an hour. So anybody that's buying labor on the market, and that's what happens when we work, they figure, well, hell, why shouldn't I buy it as cheapest rate possible? So the idea that we have a certain standard of living, in a good part driven up artificially, which is not always bad. In fact, I would say it's not bad at all, by union demands and by government statute, that is the minimum wage, we're the old pricing ourselves out of the labor market. So in other words, if I said next year to my boss, they said, all right, we want you to sign a contract. And I said, I want $2 million or I'm not coming back in. Well, guess what? I wouldn't be back in, right? Because I would have priced myself out of the labor market. However, we're talking about wages that aren't up in the stratosphere. We're talking about wages that distributed wealth that was created here by all of us, particularly the people at the point of production and in the shops and the offices and what have you. And it was decided there was a social settlement, if you will, sort of an agreement quite a long time ago that this wealth had to be shared, that we didn't want an aristocracy of multimillionaires, and now, of course, it's billionaires, and then essentially an industrial and agricultural peasantry. So beginning in the 1930s, the settlement was that the wealth would be shared. Now the people that control everything, the ruling class, the class of rulers, have decided, for some reason that puzzles me, because they were doing all right during the settlement. They were still had everything they wanted, right? We know how the rich live, and it's not like either the middle class or the working class, and certainly not the poor, lived in some grandee style, right? And particularly because even before all this began, say 2007, remember that guy that used to be President Bush? During Bush's terms, that they estimated there was about 12% poverty in this country. It was probably double that easily. And then there was probably another 10 or 15% that would be considered near poor. So that, you're getting up to around 30 and 40% of the people that didn't live what we would consider a middle-class life. They didn't have the wherewithal to consume in the manner that would provide them with the standard that a lot of us have come to expect. So, but anyway, back to Mexico. Mexico's manufacturing sector increased 8.2%, and driven mostly by what Mexican officials called regaining health in the auto and electronics industries, the engine of the economy along the border, these milicadores, these are mostly, not exclusively, but are American companies, again, drawn by the fact that labor unions there don't have the capacity to have a middle class, demand a middle class standard of living through the wage that the workers are paid. How about this? How about if I turn down my headphones? Okay, I won't feedback on me. So let's see. Even in Ciudad Juarez, which has both the highest level of violence and the largest number of milicadoras, that's the factories, added 1.3 more jobs in their economy. So they're adding jobs in a healthy way. And, we're losing them. We're still continuing to lose them. And as it turns out, better lives for Mexicans cut allure of going north. How about this? The extraordinary Mexican migration that delivered millions of illegal immigrants to the United States over the past 30 years has sputtered to a trickle. You know, these right-wingers are still going, it's these immigrants that are dying. Well, guess what? They're not coming in here very much anymore. And research points to a surprising cause, unheralded changes in Mexico that have made staying at home more attractive. So we're looking at a situation where the jobs are leaving. And what's left? Either nothing or jobs that pay a lot less, jobs that aren't unionized, increasingly jobs we're going to find that are under the table and aren't even minimum wage. And we're looking at this debt limit deal where the United States, the richest country in the world, is on the verge of defaulting on its debt obligations because the Republicans are insisting that the ultra wealthy, the corporations, pay no more taxes than they are. Already the lowest corporate taxes in the industrialized world, already the lowest amount of tax on the ultra wealthy. Here's what one of these right wingers said. I don't want to give their name. Says the same experts who got us into this mess are now telling us the only way out of our debt crisis is to increase revenue. That means taxes. Now, the experts that got us into us were, were present during the Bush administration and really began during the Reagan era. I mean, the Democrats never did enough to withstand all this or to resist it. But essentially it's Reaganomics. Reagan, the absolute worst president the United States has ever had. And his policies have sunk great percentages of this country. And these may be the good old days. So here, by not creating more, the only way they're saying essentially, liberals are telling us that the only way out of our debt crisis is to increase revenue. This is a right winger talking. Not by creating more jobs and therefore a larger tax base. No, they want to increase revenue by raising taxes on job creators who are already taxed enough. This is nonsense. Their tax rate has fallen. Their personal rate of tax, their corporate tax, right? And they've got all this money hidden offshore. They're sitting on mountains of cash. And here's what the right winger continued. We have been blessed with natural resources, hardworking entrepreneurs, and a constitution that preserves the... If we develop those natural resources, allow our entrepreneurs to keep and invest more of what they earn, we will prosper and endure. This is absolute nonsense. They have all the money they want. This is what's called supply-side economics. In other words, if you free up cash for the upper 1% and the corporations, they will say, wow, we can make more money by opening up more businesses and hiring more people. And then, the circle continues. Then they hire more people, people have more money, except it doesn't work. It never has worked. Here's what Paul Krugman says, a Nobel Prize-winning economist. Consciously or not, policymakers are catering almost exclusively to the interests of those who derive income from assets. Not from income, but from owning, from assets. This is the ruling class. This is the moneyed class. This is the financial elite. But those who derive income from assets, who lent large sums of money in the past, often unwisely, he says, this is what caused the problem that we're facing, but are now being protected from loss at everyone else's expense. So when they talk about shared sacrifice, they're really not talking about shared sacrifice. They're talking about you and your neighbors and me and almost everybody in this country paying for the mistakes that these investors made. Krugman says creditor interests naturally prevail because, quote, this is the class that makes big campaign contribution. It's the class that has personal access to policymakers, many of whom go to work for these people when they exit government through the revolving door. So it's a racket. It's a con game. It's a scam. And they want us to pay for it. And even President Obama is starting to buy into this crap where he's talking about putting Medicare and Social Security up for possibility of cuts. No cuts, no compromise at all. Tax the rich. Tax the rich heavily. Tax all unused wealth. In other words, you got to use it or lose it. This is the wealthiest country in the world. There's no reason anybody should be foreclosed. There's no reason anyone should lose a job other than that too few people have too much money, and it ain't working. Well, the Senate Democrats have drafted a debt reduction plan. Senate Democrats drafted a sweeping debt reduction plan that would slice $4 trillion from projected borrowing over the next decade without touching the health and retirement programs. And instead, Senate Democrats are proposing to stabilize borrowing through sharp cuts at the Pentagon. Hello? That's a good idea. And other government agencies, as well as $2 trillion in new taxes, primarily on families earning more than $1 million a year. Republicans dismissed the Democratic blueprint, saying higher taxes would be devastating to an economy already weighed down by 9.2% unemployment rate. How? They never explain it. They just say it. How would people with that amount of money that actually have absolutely no way or nowhere to spend it, how is keeping or allowing them to keep all that wealth actually doing anybody any good? Even them. It's not. You say, hey, I got $40 billion. You know, so what? I mean, it doesn't do them any good. I mean, they can't spend all that. That's why is there anyone listening that wants money for any reason other than they would like to buy, fill in the blank? Maybe up to the most insane consumption? Or, you know, a few of us would say, hey, I want to give some, you know, to help people. And these guys are making extraordinary amounts of money. Preliminary examination of executive pay in 2010 found the paychecks for top American executives were growing again. The final figures showed that the median pay for top executives at the 200 big companies last year was $10.8 million. That works out to a 23% gain from 2009. So where's the shared sacrifice? Workers are being forced to not take raises or to take pay cuts. City workers are being furloughed off of Fridays, so they're getting 20% less pay and all that. These guys, they got 23% more money than they did the year before. Total CEO pay hasn't quite returned to its heady pre-recession levels, but it certainly seems headed there. Despite the soft economy, weak home prices, and persistently high unemployment, some top executives are already making more than they were before the economy soured. Now, everybody is totally pissed off about Casey Anthony getting off. Why aren't you so angry at and put yourself in any category and think about the kind of movements that that took place in this country since its origin, where a mass movement blew off this colonial master, England, and set up our own country, and then went through abolitions and women's suffrages. And I'm just reading this book about the prohibition movement. I mean, we don't want prohibition, but they had themselves a movement. I mean, they controlled politics in this country between, say, like 1906 and 1920, when the prohibition amendment to the Constitution was passed. Ordinary people organized in a manner in all these cases, anti-war movements and union movements and the feminist movements and all that, the gay movement, they were able to say, no, we're not going to take it anymore. And think of all the things that I was just reading. And we're taking it. We're taking it. And in the meantime, the rich are getting richer and the rest of us are going to be getting poorer. It's done. It's a done deal. We cut Social Security, it's going to send hundreds of thousands of our seniors into poverty. They estimate 250,000. You know, 250,000 elderly people who work their ass off for some guy that's making $10 million a year. And to balance the budget, granddad or grandma is going to have to take a pay cut. What do you think? 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Peter Werby with you, Jalene Jordan out for the evening. Here's Gabe in Livonia. Gabe, hey, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just calling about how everybody was really pissed off about Casey Anthony getting off.
Yeah, what do you think?
I mean, we only know what the news and the media outlets, what they put their spin on it, you know? And I kind of feel like maybe this is me being naive. You know, I'm only 20 years old, but it could just be me being naive. But I think I would trust what 12 people who were in the courtroom every minute and heard every piece of evidence thought over what thousands of media outlets said. That's just me, but...
Well, no, that's everything I say is just me, Gabe. But, well, here's what the jurors said. I did start checking it out after it was over. They said they thought there was a good chance she may have actually been guilty, but there was not enough evidence presented. Remember, that's the calling. You have to find beyond a shadow of a doubt that the person being tried is guilty. And so it sounds like they just had to sort of, you know, bite the bullet. But the media, what was there? Some woman, Nancy Grace. I didn't even get what was going on with her. I think she was just this commentator that just did, you know, this nightly number and used it to, pump up her ratings. All right, Gabe, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here is Mike. Mike's in Waterford. Hi, Mike. You're on the air. Hey, Mike. Are you with me? Let me see. Did I do this right? Huh.
Sorry, I had the phone muted.
Oh, yeah, that's okay. Go ahead.
How you doing?
Good, good. Go ahead. You're on the air.
I just want to know if you had heard about the new internet thing they have, the filter for websites like Google and Facebook and stuff. And the way that it works is if I were to Google the Supreme Court.
Right.
And you were to Google the Supreme Court, I might get something about like some ban on video games or something, and you would get something completely different. And that's because it goes through your history and what you tend to like and stuff. And it will change your results depending on whether or not you would like that.
Well, they would probably say, well, for one thing, Mike, I can't believe, I mean, I'm sure it sounds like something that they would already have in place. And if they don't have it, I would go out and start a .com business right away with that. But, you know, they would say, hey, look, why should I get Werby something about something he doesn't care about when I know what his search patterns are? So they would say this is a benefit. But so what do you think? Invasion of privacy or is it a benefit?
Well, I mean, it's not as much of a problem as a benefit, because if you're using like a private browsing mode or something, it, you know, would automatically revert to it. But it'll actually it'll edit out certain things, differing opinions.
Okay.
And, you know, I use my computer to write papers for school all the time.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, it's really hard if you're trying to find certain things on, you know, differing opinions that are something that you don't think. So I thought, like, I mean, even if it can be useful sometimes, but I think it should be like a choice.
I hear you. Hey, you know what? A friend of mine's, was this who was telling me? I think it was. A friend of mine who's a prof at Wayne State. He was telling me, you know, before people, you could buy all these papers online or you could just, you know, go to Wikipedia and just copy it and put it in. He said now that almost every paper, every college paper gets put through a program where it searches everywhere on the internet, and if you've either, you know, gotten one from one of these services or you've just copied it online, they got you dead.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's back to doing our own work. All right, Mike, thank you very much. Let's see. Here is, this is Russell. Russell's in Newport. Hey, Russell, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'll start a couple of comments. About
sure.
Like probably like general population, I think she did it, but in the same note, you got to prove how, and you know, just thinking that someone did it a certain way is a guess. So I mean, I think justice was served in its own way, I guess. And another quick thing, I don't understand where nothing has been said about NAFTA. I mean, it's not brought up mean, if you look back at when that was signed, it's deindustrialized this country since it was signed. Because they, you know, anybody that's making millions of dollars can sit back, like you said, go, oh, well, if I build a factory in China, I can pay them nothing and ship it in for free.
Sure.
Sounds like a good deal to me, so.
Well, you know, Russell, I think I've said before on this program, I think part of their plan is they'll reindustrialize this country when they drive our wages down to what they're paying people in Mexico and China. And they're on their way. They're, you know, it's on the way. I mean, right now, people are getting so desperate that I'm sure if you told people, hey, we will hire you, but for half the minimum wage, people would probably say, okay, you know, we'll do it, which is pretty sad.
What do you also think about the, you know, how they're trying to deunionize it, and as far as, you know, like, if you know, for instance, my dad worked at GM, retired as GM, you know, he's got a pension and stuff, and now they're hiring everybody making $14 an hour. Well, who can afford a $50,000 vehicle at $14 an hour? So, I mean, in 20 years, if nobody's making anything, how can they afford to buy the products they're producing?
Well, you know what can happen is, like I mentioned earlier, but well, let me say two things. First off, is that the union movement, for all the flaws that it may have, and I've worked for unions, I'm a union member currently, and all of that, for and so I realize, you know, the flaws I think the union movement has is not what the people that are critical of them say. I mean, in other words, I think they're not being, you know, that they're not defending us as well as they should be, that they've gotten too comfortable and what have you. And what they did was two things. One was, of course, protect the people in their own industry, but also the union movement, forgetting about individual unions, was to create a standard of which other wage payers had to meet. Well, and they organized politically. Another, you know, they could bring out tens of thousands of people to work for Democratic Party candidates, and in many ways people think that it was virtually the UAW that won the election for Barack Obama, for better or for worse, and we're debating about that. But anyway, they were the organized political force that demanded a middle class standard of living for everybody. I mean, because they didn't, this wasn't like negotiating with an individual employer, but supported legislation going back to, you know, the first minimum wage for Social Security, 5-day week, overtime, all that stuff. Well, the union movement, the little bit of it's left, still powerful, even with 7% or whatever it is of private sector workers unionized, it still is an impediment for the plans of the ultra-rich to drive down everyone's wages. So they're really big to do major damage to the unions. And I already forgot. What was the second thing you said?
Oh, just, you know, eventually, you know, if, like my father retired from GM and, you know.
Oh, yeah, you said, how are people, if they're making $14 an hour? Well, it's what I said. If you have commodities being produced, and, well, you have commodities produced at the bottom of the wage pile or heap, what it's going to turn out to be, but they're consumed at the top, that will work if you don't care about people. If you care about everybody in society and think everybody deserves a break and that everybody is doing something important, whether you're pushing a pen or sweeping a floor, because, you know, ultimately you need it all, then you have one set of affairs that develops, because you're thinking, well, how can I look at this? And people at the bottom, how can I get them, you know, the best health care? And, you know, they're doing dirty work and dangerous work and unhealthy work frequently. How can I make sure that they have health care? How can I make sure that they have the highest wage possible? If you say, all I want is more money for my company. Well, and that's what's happening. And then, you know, those at the bottom get screwed. All right, Russell, I'm sorry. It's not a very pretty picture, but unfortunately, unless we resist in some organized fashion, that's what we're going to wind up with. And it doesn't matter what one's politics are. I mean, you get some of these working class guys that are, say, well, I'm a Republican, I'm a conservative. They're still going to eat it. Doesn't matter what their politics are. And in some ways, the guys at the top, although, you know, some of them are Democrats, most of them are Republicans, but they don't care. They don't care about their politics, ultimately. What they care about is how much cash in it can they accumulate by stopping us from getting as much as we'd like. Or let me put it the other way. They want to get as much as they can and force us to take as little as possible. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. We'll be right back. Joe and Sean and Lutato, stay on the phone.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Need new tires? Take the Bell Tire Price Challenge. We challenge you to find a lower tire price anywhere because we shop the competition every day to make sure our tire prices are the lowest. I'm Steve Richardson, a Bell Tire store manager. We challenge you to challenge us online, challenge us over the phone, or even challenge us right in the store. Come in and we'll check other stores' prices with you right at the counter and prove to you that Bell Tire has the lowest tire prices, period. For a limited time only, buy any four Michelin passenger or light truck tires and get a $70 prepaid MasterCard from Michelin. Save even more when you go to BellTire.com and join the Bell Tire Advantage. You'll receive a coupon for an additional $20 off the purchase of four new Michelin tires. Details at BellTire.com. Prove it to yourself. If you need new tires, take the Bell Tire Price Challenge today. We're confident you'll find that we have the lowest tire prices in town. Nobody beats Bell Tire.
Bell Tire, with over 80 locations there in your neighborhood. For the Bell Tire near you, call 888-GO-BELL or log on to BellTire.com. Hurry to Bell Tire today.
We met through an online dating service. A perfect match.
We had everything in common.
Even our car insurance.
We both have e-surance because we both love discounts.
We had a little scare, though, because I got all my e-surance discounts over the phone.
And I got all mine on their website.
But we realized it didn't matter how we got our discounts.
As long as we both had them.
To get your perfect car insurance discounts, get a quote today at esurance.com or 1-800-ESURANCE. E-surance, technology when you want it, people when you don't.
Not available in all states. Some restrictions apply. Discounts may vary by state. See site for details.
I love your eyes.
This is Dan Tullis, and I just called
Joel Clark,
one of Select Quote Insurance Services Term Life Agents.
Hi, Mr. Tullis.
Joel, how does Select Quote save you money on term life insurance?
Well, buying term life insurance is all about choosing the right company. Let's say you take antidepressants or you smoke. All insurance companies are going to price that differently. We'll impartially shop all the companies we represent to find you the best price.
Can you give me an example?
Sure. I just got a man, 40 years old, who takes blood pressure medication, a $500,000 policy with a highly rated insurance company. Its price, $21 a month.
Call 1-800-928-6929 and see how affordable term life insurance can be. That's 1-800-928-6929. 1-800-928-6929. Or go to selectquote.com. We shop, you save. Get full details on the example policy at selectquote.com/commercials. Your price could vary depending on your health, issuing company, and other factors. Not available in all states.
Yes. Keep it on 101 The Rift to score your very own WRIF Man Card, along with tickets to see the return of Ted Nugent, September 3rd at DTE. One lucky Rift winner will score the Ready to Rock package, including pavilion seats and parking for the Ted Nugent Show, plus Def Leppard Mayhem Festival and the Rob Zombie Slayer Show. Brought to you by your local Motor City Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Fiat Superstores and 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much. Jolene is off tonight. 313-298-9743. Facebook friends, that's pretty, you know, thanks to Debbie and to Jolene who take care of the Facebook page. I can read what's called the wall. I think a lot of you know that because a lot of you do Facebook. I don't, but so I can always read the wall. So I appreciate everybody that's taking part in that. Here is a couple of emails. Jolene usually does that. This is Tim listening in Connecticut. He says, just checking in. I listen to you every Sunday night. I told a buddy about your show in China, and he is listening to you now. I enjoy the program. Thank you very much. And sure enough, Eric writes in from Shanghai. Perhaps you received an email recently from Cold Beer Tim. He didn't sign his name like that, Eric, but he did write. We talk on Skype, and he said we should email in and say where we're listening from. I reckon I'm probably one of the farthest away listeners, aside from any Aussies and Kiwis that may be out there. Yeah, I don't know. I haven't heard from our New Zealand or Australia. What's that? I can't remember that island that is below Australia. Why? Not popping to my brain. But, yeah, what happened to Jacob in Finland? He was listening all the time. It's South Korea, Mexico. We used to say, you know, like ZZ Top says, we're bad, we're nationwide, they're selling. We're international. Let's see. George from Taylor, not so far away. When 400 billionaires, he writes to calltalkyes@yahoo.com, when 400 billionaires own more than the bottom 150 million Americans, then our democracy is lost, along with the Supreme Court rulers appointed for life and owning nothing to democracy. The rich owning oligarchy started with President Reagan, then George Bush with their tax cuts to the rich. Oh, George, you're trying to be too nice to Clinton. He did some damage, too. These Republicans spend us into trillions of dollars outside the budget with their wars and tax cuts to the rich. Now they want us to balance the budget on the old, poor, and sick. It's true. I remind them of Matthew 25. What you do for the least of these, you do for me. Yeah, they have no conscience, no heart. They're weird. I don't get it. I don't understand why they being the rich and their lackeys, their Republicans, and the conservatives are doing this. I mean, they're partly wacky. I mean, it's a little bit like that, but they had it all before. They had, you know, these fabulous wealths, fabulous riches and wealth. And why they wanted more, and why they were so greedy that they totally sank the economy, why Bush would lie us into a war, then cut taxes on the rich. Are they just crazy? I mean, do they really, I mean, I don't think people can live a 100% lie, or can they? I mean, do they actually believe that if you tax the wealthy that have all this unused wealth that's just socked away, that this will... the other way. Do they really believe if you cut taxes on the rich more that they'll create jobs? They haven't so far. And they've got all this money that's unused. I don't get it. They got to just be crazy. What do you think? I mean, is there anybody out there? I mean, there's got to be somebody out there that agrees with that, right? And, I mean, have all of you working class and middle class Republicans finally cashed it in? You know these guys are just crazy. It's just, you know, Michelle Bachmann and these nutballs. Anyway, 313-298-WRIF. I'll take one of your calls as well. Here's Sean in Ypsilanti. Sean, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? This is Sean, southwest side of Detroit.
Well, good. Welcome.
Well, I was calling about the Ashley case. A lot of people, they always like to cry.
Yeah.
When somebody gets found not guilty, but when something in general, when they get found guilty, nobody ever says nothing. So what is the deal with that? Somebody's always got something to say. Like the world right now is just bitching like mad. I'm sorry.
That's
the
okay.
world right now is crabbing like mad because he got found not guilty. She was found not guilty in a court of her peers. Why should anybody be crabbing? If she got found guilty, nobody else would be crabbing.
You know, I'm going to say this right off the top of my head, Sean. I don't know whether I'm not backing this up with anything, but I'll bet you that there's more miscarriages of justice by innocent people being found guilty than the opposite.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Everybody's always got to be crying when somebody walks away, but when somebody gets found guilty, nobody's sticking up for them people. When there are people sitting in prison right now, when there's evidence, nine after nine of evidence, and people sitting in prison for years and years and years, going through the trial when they got DNA evidence on everybody, and no, they're not pushing that.
Yeah.
You got to sit and wait.
I gotta find a website. A friend of mine who's been putting a website just did 22 years in prison for conspiracy to deliver controlled substances, cocaine. He was accused of supplying cocaine to lawyers. You know, gee, that's a terrible crime, huh? He wound up spending 22 years in prison. He was actually a businessman. I mean, you know, not a legitimate business. And I want to find his website because the details of his trial and the way the police function is all pretty interesting and worth a read. I'll get that during the break. All right, thank you. Thank you very much, Sean. Appreciate your opinions. This is Lutato from Detroit. Hey, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. I have a comment. I really don't care about that. Maybe she would ask me, Casey asked me, because, I mean, she would get hers in return. What she put out there, she's going to get back. But my concern is, as a city worker who owns disability, Social Security disability, and I had to go back to work part-time, I work for one of the state reps, and I work with the seniors in the community throughout the city of Detroit. And these seniors are truly hurting. It's across the board, you got blacks, whites, Latinos, seniors who work all their life, like you said earlier, for Social Security. It's not like they went for welfare or getting welfare. This is Social Security that we all have put into the pot. And then it seems like the Republicans are like they give us something that we sit on our butt and just asking for. We all worked hard for this. I can't receive my pension until I turn 63, and I'm 48 years old. And then just like, I don't understand, and the Congress got itself a raise 2-3 years ago. John Conyers, Carl Levin, and I can go on and on. Hanson Clark is there now.
Well, let me just intervene. I mean, what we've come to expect is people to do the right thing for us, and that's understandable. In other words, we have a, depending on the city we live in, we have a, well, let me put it another way. We have teachers, we expect them to teach and to teach well. We have a fire department and a police department, we expect them to do their job, and on and on and on. Yeah, we have people to pick up the trash, we expect them to do that well. And we expect politicians to act on our behalf in a way that benefits us. Well, they don't. And they, I mean, some of them do. The two that you mentioned, John Conyers and Hanson Clark, are two that I think are worthwhile individuals who really care about their constituents. But as a whole, they're operating as stuff I've been reading and stuff I said, in the interests of the people that have all the money. And they're working in a manner that they're expecting us to bail out the mistakes that the ultra-rich created and the politicians themselves created. So we have to intervene directly, or we're gonna have to just hope. And I don't know why hope has gotten to be such a big thing. Hope means you hope it doesn't rain during your picnic. Nothing you can do about it. You just hope, God, there's clouds up there. Hope it doesn't start raining. Or you can say, I hope they don't take away my Medicare when I turn 65. I hope they're not going to cut Social Security. I hope they're not going to cut my salary. I hope they're not going to raise the price of gas. And we're just sitting around hoping as individuals. Now, the capacity of people to coalesce, to come together, to organize mass resistance or mass desire and demand for social change comes about not, you just can't say, oh, all right, we're going to do it tomorrow. But something like that has to happen, or we're going to be stuck with hope. And that's not going to, and I'll tell you, the hope ain't going to do much good, unfortunately. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here's Joe in Monroe. Joe, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
First time, long time.
Welcome.
Hey, I'm just going to comment, and you said beyond a shadow of a doubt, and really it's beyond a reasonable doubt.
Did I use the word shadow?
You did.
Okay, and beyond a reasonable doubt. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, and I'm sure you misspoke, but let's be honest with each other. Beyond a reasonable doubt, I think they meant that, and I think I followed the case as much as you did.
Wait a minute.
Very limited.
Okay. I was going to say very, very little.
Very little, and I think I followed it as much as to the reaction of the verdict.
I got to say, Joe, I have no idea what transpired during the trial. I just heard stuff about the computer and the father, and I don't know. I have no idea what went on.
And I didn't either.
Yeah.
And I got to be honest. So I think we're both speaking on the same terms here. But I think we have probably one of the best systems in the world. But at the same time, I think we have come to a point where juries in this country are skewed by what they see on TV with. Everybody is waiting to see evidence. You gotta have DNA in every case, and you're not gonna get it in every case. And they still need to listen to the facts of the case and not wait for evidence every time.
I mean, I just have to say on that, I don't know. I mean, you could be right. I don't know whether that's, a trend that people, I mean, sure, it used to be that art imitated life, right? In other words, that a painter, usually that was what it was, would paint life. Now life imitates art, which, of course, is what's on television. So it's very possible that you could be onto something. Is that they've all, every, you know, even the jurors have watched too much CSI or Law and Order or something like that. That actually is interesting. I actually don't have a response to it because I don't have any way to figure out whether that's true or not. But maybe we can get some other comments. So the question is, are jurors, even when they're not being influenced directly, are they being indirectly affected by outside influences like the media, even though it might not sort of preformed expectations? Good point. Thank you, Joe. Appreciate it very much. Here is Jake. Jake, where are you calling from?
Yeah, Peter, this is Jake from Waterford.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, good talking to you again. It's been a while.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Welcome back.
Hey, you know, your comments about, you know, us being taxed and this trillion-dollar deficit, you know, you're right on. There's no doubt about it. And you're right about hope. Hope is a joke. It's time to do something about it, right?
Right, but we got to figure out what it is to do and who's going to do it. I mean, if you think about, I mean, why wasn't there, like, the American Revolution was in 1776, right? Why wasn't it in 1775? Or why didn't
Well, you know what I'm saying? Because in 1776, you had some dynamics that happened and some leadership and some situations, which, by the way, was taxation without representation was, of course, one of the things, but nonetheless. You know, we're looking for leadership, and we need people like you to lead. And we need people like you to lead by example.
So how do I do that?
Well, you've got a lot of people who follow you, and I think the best example would be for you to say, yes, we should raise taxes.
Oh, I
wasn't
saying that.
And you should pay more taxes.
Well, here's what you're making the mistake that so many people do. You assume that everybody in media is paying an enormous, or is making an enormous salary. For one of the things, the Democratic, people like me, and people like you, Jake, unless you make $1 million a year or more, should be paying less taxes. That the wealthy people, say over half a million, I don't like the 250,000 level, but people over half a million ought to have tax increases, and it ought to go up, considerably. So that when you people that are making 10 million, if we're in a crisis situation now, maybe they should be paying 80% taxes, so that they wind up with only $2 million for the year. Because there's no reason. I mean, are you wealthy, Jake?
No, but what is the average income of a U.S. citizen?
You know what? It's not very high, and there's average and there's median. Mine is about average. I'll tell you that.
All right.
So
anybody
which ain't much.
50,000 is above average.
Right. Right. And I actually somebody sent me some. I think they said it was $47,000. So they're only 20% of the population makes over $100,000 a year. 80% of the population makes below $100,000.
So should we have 80% of the population go ahead and tell the other 20 what they should do? That doesn't sound very democratic either, now, does it?
Well,
and I'll tell you about this other
thing. Wait. It's very democratic because what you start having is the capacity of the wealthy when they're not involved, like when you and I mean, how much beyond our disposable income do we have? In other words, we may have a little bit of savings, but we don't have billions or let's say millions. We don't have millions individually to buy elections the way these brothers called the Koch brothers, K-O-C-H. That they have essentially bought American democracy because of the enormous wealth they have. And if you start going, you know, through the Republicans, and Democrats also have millionaires backing them, but they're not trying to enact legislation that would ruin the middle class and take money away from the working class and you know, further impoverish the poor. So all of these conservative organizations from the Tea Party up and down are all financed by these millionaires and these billionaires. And it just isn't, that's undemocratic. And does it make sense to level the playing field through taxation? Yeah, I think it makes a great sense, because 80% of the people tell somebody that is making $10 million a year, say, well, let's take the CEO of Walmart, who makes, I forget, like $23 million. And one of the reasons that he and the owners of Walmart are multi-billionaires is because they were able to keep wages down here and drive wages down to almost nothing in Asia, for instance. So I don't think that's very democratic. So one of the things that by taking their wealth from them, it also takes their undemocratic power that they have way beyond what any individual should have, and they did not work for it. There's not one of those five Walmart owners worked for their money. They got it all from Dad. They got it all from Sam. And that doesn't sound very democratic to me. All right. Thanks a lot.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Need new tires? Take the Bell Tire Price Challenge. We challenge you to find a lower tire price anywhere, because we shop the competition every day to make sure our tire prices are the lowest. I'm Steve Richardson, a Bell Tire store manager. We challenge you to challenge us online, challenge us over the phone, or even challenge us right in the store. Come in and we'll check other stores' prices with you, right at the counter, and prove to you that Bell Tire has the lowest tire prices, period. For a limited time only, get Michelin Harmony Touring All-Season Passenger Tires for only $89 each. And Goodyear Integrity Touring All-Season Passenger Tires are a great value at just $98 each. Go to BellTire.com for all the details. Prove it to yourself. If you need new tires, take the Bell Tire Price Challenge today. We're confident you'll find that we have the lowest tire prices in town. Nobody beats Bell Tire.
Bell Tire is open late Monday and Thursday, 8 to 8. Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, 8 to 6. And Saturday, 8 to 5. For the Bell Tire near you, go to BellTire.com.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Everything that rocks. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julene.
Thank you very much. Welcome to our second hour. Julene is off this evening. If you'd like to email us, I'm still saying us because she's always here. Call talkyes at yahoo.com. Facebook friends wanted, facebook.com/nightcall. A lot of good stuff going on there. And thanks to Debbie for doing so much with that. We'll have a podcast at noon on Monday available for you. How about this? In Onondaga, New York, police say a motorcyclist participating in a protest riot against helmet laws in upstate New York died after he flipped over the bike's handlebars and hit his head on the pavement. State troopers say he was driving an 83 Harley. A group of bikers were protesting helmet laws by not wearing helmets. Troopers say he hit his brakes, the motorcycle fishtailed, the bike spun out of control, and he toppled over the handlebars. He was pronounced dead at a hospital. Troopers say he would have likely survived had he been wearing a helmet. And I don't know, I'm always sort of mixed on stuff like that. You say, who's the government, you know, tell me I got to wear a helmet? I mean, they're... Who really pushes those laws are the insurance companies, because they don't want to do the payouts on them. And you think, hey, man, it's my head. If I want to crush it or because I want the wind in my hair and all that, that's my biz. But there's a social cost as well. I mean, it's a lot of accidents. A lot of times you and I wind up paying for it. I'm sort of libertarian on that. I mean, I guess before I had a motorcycle before the helmet laws, and man, I would never get on it. I wouldn't go down the driveway without it on. In fact, crashed one time, and I think if I hadn't had it on, I probably would have had some severe problems. I mentioned earlier the Koch brothers, K-O-C-H, billionaire Koch brothers, who had just hosted the conservative governors of the states. They did it, of course, in Ritzy Vale, and they're planning the next move to destroy the middle class. And if you say the Koch brothers, who the hell is that? K-O-C-H. Go to my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.com. And that will tell you. And also, nice picture of Jolene there. Fair one of me. And let's see, what else? Oh, yeah, at 1 a.m. Eastern time, we're going to have a couple of pre-recorded. What does pre-recorded mean? Recorded, right? That's a crazy word. Pre-recorded was something that was done before a recording, right? Anyway, Christian Parente's written. This is a couple of wrist slitters, I'll tell you. But we should get all the information. Christian Parente, Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change, the New Geography of Violence, connects all the violence and unrest going around the world to global warming. Well, that's a stretch, Pete. Well, check this out and tell me after. And also, during the Vietnam War, what the Vietnamese call the American War, there were assassinations of gung-ho officers by a process called fragging. A lot of times, fragmentation grenades would be tossed in, pardon me, to the tents of an officer that was disliked or too gung-ho. So I've interviewed an author that's written a book called Fragging, Why U.S. Soldiers Assaulted Their Officers in Vietnam. All of that at my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. And let's see, some open lines at 313-298-WRIF. Where is all our money going? U.S. War has launched since the attacks of September 11th have left 225,000 people dead and up to $4.4 trillion, according to a new study by university researchers at Brown University, focusing on the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and counterterrorism campaigns in Pakistan and Yemen. The authors argue that governments almost always go to war underestimating the potential duration and cost of a conflict while overestimating the political objectives that can be accomplished by the use of force. Studies said an extremely conservative estimate of the casualty toll was about 225,000 people killed and 365,000 people wounded in the wars so far. Number of soldiers killed comes to 31,000, including about 6,000 Americans, 1,200 Allied, 10,000 Iraqis, almost 9,000 Afghans, 3,500 Pakistanis, 2,300 U.S. contractors. Civilian toll was much higher, with an estimated 172,000 dead, including about 125,000 Iraqis. It wasn't such a good idea to have these wars on any level. Study acknowledged that estimating the number of dead was difficult. Up to 20,000 to 51,000 insurgents killed, 168 reporters, 266 humanitarian workers. Thank you, George W. Bush. Man, he's just keeps giving, doesn't he? 7.8 million displaced people, mostly in Iraq and Afghanistan. Study estimated the financial cost of the war is at a minimum of $3.7 trillion and up to $4.4 trillion. Anybody think that was a good idea? 313-298-WRIF. This is Justin in Dearborn Heights. Justin, hi, you're on the air.
Hey.
What's up?
I just want to say about Justin Verlander's 12th win.
Yeah, he did. Tonight?
Yeah.
Yeah? How about that? Man's honestly think he's going to get 20 games?
Probably.
Be nice to see him pitching in a World Series, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Keep your fingers crossed.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Justin. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Here is Dave in Lincoln Park. Dave, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Pete?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. I was just going to say about the deficit and all that.
Sure.
Yeah, I was actually been watching C-SPAN a lot lately, and there was a couple different things I wanted to say that well, for one thing, to reduce, like, the debt, like, one plan I've heard that was proposed, there was cut, like, say, 20% on the in the defense.
Sure.
Eliminate the Bush tax cuts.
Sure.
And then decrease the tariffs.
Yeah.
And that would probably, and they said that would cut.
Decrease the tariffs?
Yeah. Yeah, between us and other countries.
I thought those tariffs were almost all gone because of
they're charging high, you know, they're charging high tariffs on us.
Oh, so
yeah, they have low tariffs. So, like, you know, taxes back and forth.
Sure.
So, like, you know, so, like, it's, that's why we can import, you know, cheap goods from, say, China or India or somewhere else, you know,
mm-hmm.
and then yet it costs so much for, you know, that's why you don't see anything overseas. Like, say, just recently I heard that there was they opened up new trade agreements between South Korea, Panama, and Colombia.
Well, they want all these so-called free trade agreements, which does nothing. It does a lot for the corporation and does nothing for American workers. Just drains more jobs. Whenever you hear free trade, that means there's going to be jobs lost in the United States. You can bet on it. Anytime a corporation or a government official talks about free, you got to worry. Yeah, we, you and me have a different concept of what constitutes free or freedom. Like the free market. If somebody wants a free market, what they essentially want, again, it's part of driving our wages down. Or they don't want, controls on pollution, or they don't want a minimum wage or something like that.
Right.
Yeah. So you gotta be careful. We all have to be careful of that. But I just wonder, what I was saying at the beginning of the show, and maybe, these are concepts that are tough to deal with. But the Republicans have something that is called supply-side economics. In other words, that if you give the already wealthy, if you give the already cash-flushed corporations money, they will then go out and create new business opportunities and hire more people, and then those people will spend more money, and it'll have a sort of an accelerator effect. Except they're not starting. They got all this cash. They're not starting any new businesses. They're just rewarding themselves handsomely and their stockholders. And I wonder, could they really believe that if we cut the taxes on the wealthy, that somehow that this time around, that they would create more jobs? I mean, they haven't so far. What we really need is demand side. So if we put more money in the hands of the average person, so that would be twofold. One is that you would take all of this money that's already government spending going to the Pentagon and using it for more labor-intensive projects like rebuilding our infrastructure, building schools, more hiring more teachers. Rather than laying off teachers, laying off public sector workers, actually hiring more through the government, that would create the kind of beautiful society that you see in some countries but ain't here anymore. I mean, rather than this deterioration, we would have growth, and we would have people. Oh, let me give you an example. One of the things that's happening, it used to be in Wisconsin prisons that work was done, including like landscaping, by union workers. And what this meant was that people doing the work over there were getting a middle class wage. They had a secure job. And they consumed. This is the motor of capitalism, right? Labor and consumption. I mean, profits too. But, so now they have prisoners doing it. No more union labor. You go, oh good. That's double good. We got rid of these union fat cats and we've got these damn prisoners working for their keep. Well, you could almost, and I stress almost, see the sentiment here. But what that means is you've taken somebody out of the workforce and essentially have slave labor. What amendment? Is it the 13th Amendment that abolishes slavery? It says that it abolishes involuntary servitude except for, I forgot the language. It's in my briefcase, the Constitution. Pardon me. But it says, for punishment for crimes or something like that. So what we have free, well-paid labor replaced by slave labor. Could that be generalized, do you think? I mean, could we have prisoners working in auto factories? No, of course not. Oh, that's ridiculous, isn't it? Isn't it? Here is Robert in Garden City. Hi, Robert, you're on the air. Hey, Robert.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Is this Peter Werby?
It is. Is this Robert
Peter
Werby? Is this Robert from Garden City?
Yes, it is.
Dude, you are on the air. This is your 15 seconds of fame.
Okay. Peter?
Yes.
You should be president of the country.
You think so?
I have so much respect for you, and you are the smartest man around the country, and I believe every word you say. And I just wanted to ask you one question, Peter.
What?
Are they going to cut Social Security benefits?
Well, I'll tell you, Robert, they just very well may. Are you on Social Security?
Yes, I am. I worked for 50 years to get my Social Security, and I'm worried they're going to cut my Social Security and I won't be able to survive.
Well, they're not going to cut it that bad. Although, I don't know. You know, once it's like give them an inch and they take a mile. They want to get money in order to solve certain problems, not go after the people that really have it or have it financed by the sectors that do. And people don't raise a stink. So your job, Robert, raise a stink. Thank you very much. So, yeah, so when I don't know how many seniors are listening to this show, but most of you, I would bet that the majority of you have parents that are alive, and probably a good proportion of you have grandparents that are alive. Well, if they have some independent source of income, maybe they go, oh, yeah, they're going to cut $150 a month. Who cares? I mean, if they got a lot of money. If that's all they have, and there's people, I know people, elderly, that'll give them $700-$800 a month. You know, they got to get a lot of other supplements, partly from family. You know what they could do? They could actually increase Social Security. What do you think about that? They shouldn't be talking about cutting it. They should be talking about raising Social Security, because then what would happen? These people would spend it, right? This is Keynesian economics, as it's called. It's the, I mean, we have warfare state Keynesian economics. That is to say, the largest amount of state appropriated wealth being passed through the government to the private sector through the war economy. So we're a permanent warfare state. The only thing is, this just doesn't work that well. And you go, well, why? Hey, they're spending it. What's the diff? They're spending it on building a bridge or building, you know, or buying some multi-million dollar bomber. It's, again, it's war industries are capital intensive and not labor intensive. And what we want to be financing through all that money that goes through the government that takes our wealth. The other thing is, too, there ought to be a $50,000, I haven't said this one along, a $50,000 tax deduction. So people don't even start paying taxes till they make over $50,000. So if you make $51,000, you're paying tax on $1,000. That's what it would be. One of the things that you could do real easily is take the cap off of the FICA. What is that? You know, the payroll tax. Right now, I think it's capped at about $110,000. So we were talking earlier about these CEOs that are making more and more money. As more and more jobs are lost here and the average income drops more and more, these guys are making more and more money. So if they're making $10 million a year, that was the median, I think. Was the median or the average? It was the median, which means half make less, half make more. And some of them are making, you know, $125 million a year. They would pay FICA tax all the way up to their $125 million. Okay? Then what's wrong with that? This would provide all sorts of income to finance Social Security. And if you say, I mean, there's another option, and that would be this nutso libertarian idea that you just virtually get rid of government completely and yet still have capitalism. Well, I don't know. It would be like it would be like Charles Dickens. It would be the way capitalism was in the 1830s and 1840s. Just have this rich class and everybody else would be poor. You know, people would work 16 hours a day. You would have no safety or health considerations. Nobody would have retirement. You wouldn't get any. There'd be no minimum wage, nothing. It wouldn't be dog eat dog. It would be them eating, those dogs eating us. That's what it would be like. So once you enter the realm of the idea that capitalism has to be controlled, because what it allows free reign of is people's worst instincts, mostly greed, right? And from that, you can rationalize anything. Those people are poor because they didn't try hard enough. They, or any number of other excuses why you are so absolutely wealthy and powerful and living in such extraordinary, luxurious circumstances. And 20 blocks away, people are sleeping on the street. Well, they, you know, they must have done something wrong. They didn't get a good education, or I don't know. They're not trying hard enough. Whatever have you. So once capitalism was established, you know, you can date it at different times. But let's talk about, say, beginning in the 16th century, and people were really aghast at the way capitalism functioned, because feudalism, which never really worked very well, but there was what they called reciprocity. People were supposed to take care of one another. The peasants worked for the lord, and then the lord protected them and, you know, took care of them to some extent. I mean, sure, they treated them like cattle, the worst of them, and what have you, because they didn't have any rights, and again, it was greed and rationalization that allowed the system to function. But at least that was an ideal. So people were horrified when there wasn't even a pretense of reciprocity, of people helping one another. So at the beginning of capitalism, and this year, by the way, is the 200th anniversary of the Luddites. There's a great band in Detroit called the Luddites. Go see them if you ever get a chance. But the Luddites were a movement of machine breakers who said that the factory system is destroying the spirit of human beings, the quality of our goods, and and our communities. So they would, they and others in England would assassinate factory owners. They would burn factories down. They would destroy machinery. And there was no free market. I mean, finally, the English government had to permanently station like 20,000 troops up in Lancaster and places up in northern England, where the first manufacturing of woolen goods took place. So, I mean, you couldn't even have capitalism, industrial capitalism, without the direct intervention of the state and, you know, it privileging the owners. And, you know, obviously they became, they soon owned parliament. So then there was hundreds of years of struggles of people saying, hey, could we just work 12 hours a day and then 8 hours a day? And people got out in the street and said, we demand an 8-hour a day. You know, cops and National Guard shot them down, shot them in the back, shot their kids, shot their wives, you know, fired them, did all this stuff. And now, these days, something like Walmart, if you organize a shop, they close the store, right? So it's been this struggle, then finally through the government, because things got, it looked like revolution was on the agenda in the early 1930s because of the Depression. So that's why Roosevelt brought in the New Deal and said, okay, we're going to have a minimum wage. We're going to have, you're going to have a right to organize unions. You're going to have Social Security, Medicare, things like that. So there's been this long, slow struggle of trying to get people a decent standard of living. And all the while, the ultra-rich fought every inch of the way against this, right? And always you had these, you know, they needed shock troops, right? Some of it they bought. There was a guy, who was this? One of the robber barons, famously in the 19th century, said, I can hire one half of the working class to shoot down the other half, because there was all these strikes. People wanted, you know, to make a little bit more than they were making. And they did. I mean, in order to protect their wealth, and then there's this great psychopathology that goes with this ownership of huge sums of cash, that you would think that these guys would, you know, like the owners of Walmart then, or these robber barons then, would say, well, what the hell, man, I've got so much money, I've got millions back then and billions now, why don't I just you know, give everybody everything in terms of better standard of living and, you know, great health plans for my stores and all that, and everybody would love me instead of you know, making signs about you and saying you're a horrible person. So there is this factor of irrationality for it. But everything that's been won is starting to fray and starting to peel off. So we're going to get back to what, the 19th century, the 18th century? I don't know. But it sure is, we're sure not going to be able to tell till we're there, unless we put up resistance at every point. And I was talking the other week about deindustrialization, and I said that I mean, this is easy for me to say, and I don't know that it even occurred to anybody. But when the first union shop left Detroit for Alabama, like in 1953, Walter Reuther should have called a general strike in auto. All, you know, the big three called out everybody. Said, you're not bringing any union job out of here and bring it down south with half the wages and no benefits and a virtual police state and a total segregationist racist social system. And we're not making another car in the United States until you bring that plant back here. Or the first, rather, went the other way around. The first job that said, oh, we're taking our job to Mexico because we don't have to pay you a union wage or even a good non-union wage. We get somebody to do it for $1.25 an hour. The government should have said, okay, you can take your plant, but there's going to be a $10 million or $100 million exit fee, right? And, oh, you moved your plant to China? You could bring your goods back in? Oh, there's a real high tariff. Because we're not letting you do this, but it's all gone, and nobody did anything, and then it went the other way around with NAFTA and CAFTA and South Korean free trade thing. So here's the choice. I've said it once, probably said it 100 times. We have two choices: either put up some resistance that is strong enough to stop all this, or just thatch our roofs and admit we're peasants. And say, please, sir, don't kill everything so fast. Those are the choices. Huh? What do you think? 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Here's Randy in Troy. Hey, Randy, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, Peter, how are you?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Hey, I've been waiting to hear from you. I need some enlightenment from you. You're talking this is Randy from Troy. I'm 29. And, you know, I represent the new generation.
Okay.
And, you know, and what I noticed is that it's just like we have a cold war almost right now of poor versus rich, almost like the baby boomers versus the hippies. And,
yeah.
You know, it's like, how do we, I mean, what can we possibly do? I can't think of any way I can make a difference in something like gas prices, you know, and me as a small business owner, if you gave me $1 million, I would spend it, and it's good for the economy. But we have a problem when companies like these, like the oil companies, are taking huge pools of money and just yanking them out of the economy.
Sure.
And it's like, now I would expect, now for what little I have, you're not going to get it from me just by asking. So we can't expect the super rich to just start spreading the wealth around and feel bad for us. But
well, I hear you, Randy. And one of the things that the first thing that someone should say to me, and in a way, I think that's what you're asking. Okay, it's it's going to be daytime on Monday in about 8 hours or so. I'm ready for the resistance. Where do I report for duty? And it's not there. I mean, yet in any mass form. I mean, there's on the economic and jobs fronts. There's something called, Jobs with Justice. I think if you just look that up, Jobs with Justice, and they, you know, they've done everything from actions around foreclosures to, I'm trying to think of some of the other work they've done, to supporting public sector workers, and the actions are small. I mean, if you've read histories of the civil rights movement or the anti-war movement or the suffragette or going way back, the abolitionist movement, those were these tremendous mass movements that grabbed the conscience of the nation. Well, there's all sorts of activity that's going on currently every day in this town, except that it doesn't have any mass proportions to it. So, and I'll tell you, every once in a while, something will happen, and I think, well, I'm going to announce this on this show, because I would say from what people call in and from the email I get that it sounds like 90% agreement. The conservatives seem to have either given up on the show completely or everybody's changed their mind when they see what reality is like. And I say, okay, there's going to be a demonstration in support of our teachers you know, that teach our kids, that teach, you know, the real new generation. It's going to be on the corner of Nine Mile and Woodward. Might be far for a lot of people. I realize that. You know, this was a few weeks ago. I mean, 50 people showed up, and I knew about 40 of them. So people don't even respond yet. And it's not like I'm saying, you know, oh, you're not coming to church. You're a bad church member. I'm not talking about you. I'm not talking people that didn't show up. Because things have a way historically of sometimes happening and sometimes not. Like I said, why wasn't there an American Revolution in 1775 instead of 1776? I don't know.
I think we're currently going through a revolution right now, and people don't have time or resources to even voice their opinion because we work 7 days a week just to make it. I know people that are doing making huge sacrifices just to survive, and I think from a new generation, like how was the 50s? I mean, you only had to work 8 hours and then that's it, and you got benefits, and everybody went up north for every weekend.
Everybody, all the auto workers at homes at Houghton Lake. That was always, you know, going to Houghton Lake, you must work for Ford, right? Yeah. Listen, I, because of the work that I do, I'm fortunate enough when, you know, you broadcast, you're not putting in an 8 hour day, at least on the air. So I have a lot of time to do a lot of my work at home, and I do that. And I have a lot of other duties here. I'm what's called the public affairs director for Greater Media's 3 stations in Detroit. So I have other tasks, but I don't have the kind of pressures that a lot of people do, as you're saying, that are, say, working 50 hours a week, have kids, maybe even kind of go to school at the same time. But I have to say that in other eras, you know, like when the union movement was first taken off, those workers not only did they, work 10 hours a day, and have families and what have you, but they also had company goons and sheriff's deputies and Ford's service department, as they called it, beating the crap out of people. They had also in Detroit in the late 1930s, the heyday of the unions, they had something called the Black Legion, which was like the Ku Klux Klan that murdered union organizers, attacked Catholics, and attacked Jews, the Ku Klux Klan did. So I fully understand about people having packed lives, and I don't have any kids, so it gives me a lot of free time. But people in other eras had that same demands on their time. All right, we'll figure it out, Randy. I do believe. Thank you for your call. Here is Chris in Detroit. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. How you doing this evening?
Doing good. Welcome.
My idea or thought is I'm having trouble with banks and as well as the credit bureaus. And my thought is being that they do freely trade our information freely being they don't pay us. I think we should all be receiving royalties whenever they sell our loans. Sure. They should be paying at least 1 to 2% buyer or seller on our loans, which would cut down our debt.
Chris, I love that.
You know, I heard the musicians, they wanted a royalty when their music got played on the radio. How come we and our information, how come we're not receiving royalties on our information?
Hey, you know, Chris, when you buy a house, they have like all these little fees, like processing fees. I'm thinking,
totally.
Why don't we get something when they, the hometown mortgage company, and soon it's owned by some conglomerate somewhere else, right?
And my thought is it could be taxed heavier. It's income we're not seeing anyways.
Sure.
And that way the government gets their cut as if they don't already out of our taxes on our property. But my thought is the credit bureaus really don't care who they give our information to. They're co-conspirators in identity theft themselves.
Yep.
And legislation won't do anything about that. And I'm wondering who we do talk to, or should we all get on the phone and call them and say, hey, why aren't we receiving our royalties? Why are they giving our information to anyone who wants to steal our identities?
I hear you. Well, I don't think calling them is going to do any good. I mean, that's in the realm of legislation. You know, at the beginning of the 20th century, there was a whole period of what they called the progressive era. and they put in all these reforms that, again, this was part of this huge mass movement that wanted to stop the worst abuses of the system. And in a lot of ways, we have a new system. I mean, it's very similar in, you know, to what they had then, these oligarchies, these, you know, this small group of extraordinarily wealthy people that controlled everything, that bought Congress, and pretty much just left the average person to their own resources. And maybe it's time for another progressive movement. All right, Chris, thank you very much. Hey, you know, I don't know what happened to my little recording of the Beatles. Happiness is a warm gun. Yes, it is. When I put my finger on your trigger. You know, you remember that song. Residents of Wheatland, Wyoming, a quiet agricultural town in central Wyoming, plan a community barbecue to raise money for funeral expenses for victims of a shooting spree. Authorities say a man opened fire inside a mobile home Thursday night, killing his three sons and a brother. The man's wife was wounded. Man, could you imagine? I always think about that. And the wife recovers, and her sons are dead and by the hand of her husband. Mayor Gene Dixon. Gene Dixon, wow, says the killings are shocking to residents of Wheatland, I could imagine. Everett E. Conant III, who's in his mid-30s, surrendered without incident. And I think you saw this up in Grand Rapids. Seven dead in related shootings. I couldn't even follow all this. Seven people, including a child, have been killed in related shootings in Grand Rapids. And let's see, where was this? A four-year-old boy shot while watching Baltimore fireworks. Two shot during massive brawl outside Atlantic City Casino. And then we have, oh, we have a couple of things going. Here are these gun nuts, man. You know, like these Republicans. Ohio Republican Governor John Kasich on Thursday signed into law a bill that allows gun owners in the state to carry concealed weapons into bars and other places where alcohol is served. Businesses can ban concealed weapons on their premises for safety reasons if they want to. How would they know if it's concealed? And some, like the Cincinnati Bengals football team, have indicated they will continue to bar gun owners from bringing firearms into the stadium. It must be owned by liberals or something like that. The law prohibits gun owners from consuming alcohol. Well, that's good. We're sure they won't do that, or being under the influence of alcohol or drugs when they carry their weapons into bars. I think that's good. Well, I don't know. I think maybe we got to get the NRA on this. Why can't you be drunk when you're walking into a bar with your gun? These damn liberals. The new law allows residents to carry concealed handguns into licensed establishments in the state, including shopping malls and sporting venues. Also allows a person with a concealed carry permit to transport a loaded handgun in a motor vehicle without securing it in a holster, case, bag, or box. You know, just put it on the seat. But got to get the NRA on this. What they're doing is trying to make sure that people that have histories of mental illnesses can petition to get their gun rights back. Can you believe this? This is true. And what they're doing is a handful of states that have restoration laws on their books. And here's a case. May 2009, Sam French hit bottom once again. A relative found him face down in his carport, talking gibberish, according to court records. He later told medical personnel he had been conversing with a bear in his backyard and hearing voices. His family figured he had gone off his meds for bipolar, and a judge ordered him involuntarily committed the fourth time in 5 years he had been hospitalized by court order. When Mr. French's daughter discovered that her father's commitment meant it was illegal for him to have firearms, she and her husband removed his catch of 15 long guns and 3 handguns and kept them after Mr. French was released in January 2010. He began taking mood-stabilizing drugs. 10 months later, he appeared, this is in Pulaski, Virginia, he appeared in General District Court, the body that handles small claims, to ask a judge to restore his gun rights. After a brief hearing in which Mr. French's lengthy history of relapses never came up, he walked out with an order reinstating his right to possess firearms. The next day, Mr. French retrieved his guns. Mr. French said, the judge didn't ask me a whole lot. He just said, how was I doing? Was I taking my medicine like I was supposed to? I said, yes, sir. Across the country, states are increasingly allowing people like Mr. French, who lost their firearms rights because of mental illness, to petition to have them restored. As a condition of its support for the measure, the National Rifle Association extracted a concession in this federal law that the inclusion of a mechanism for restoring firearm rights to those who lost them for mental health reasons. You know what? These people are crazy.
You are listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Do you know someone who's having a birthday this month? Don't let the date sneak up and catch you unprepared. Have ProFlowers send beautiful birthday flowers. They make flower deliveries easy and affordable. And get this incredible radio special. Yours right now. 100 stunning birthday blooms plus a free glass vase for just $19.99. Play it smart. Go online to ProFlowers.com. Look for the microphone in the upper right corner and enter the secret code FAST. Why overpay at a florist when you can get huge savings on one full 100 stunning birthday blooms for just $19.99 at ProFlowers. They'll even throw in a free vase. With a deal like this, you can take care of all the important people in your life and schedule that special birthday delivery weeks in advance. But hurry, this $19.99 birthday deal won't last forever. And the only way to get it is to go to ProFlowers.com. Look for the microphone in the upper right corner and enter the secret code FAST. One more time, write it down. ProFlowers.com. Secret code FAST. Got it? ProFlowers.com. Secret code FAST.
Homeowners, how do you find the right contractor when you want something built? How do you find the best service professional when you need something fixed? For any type of service for your home, go to the most trusted website for pre-screened home pros. Just go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. Service Magic is a free online resource that instantly connects you with pre-screened remodelers, maids, repairmen, and many other home contractors. If you need a plumber, electrician, painter, or any other home pro, visit fixitfast.servicemagic.com. It's easy and it's free, and it's the smartest way to find neighbor-rated contractors in your area. Over 10 million homeowners have trusted Service Magic for their home improvement and maintenance projects. So hire a pre-screened home pro with confidence. Go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. fixitfast.servicemagic.com. That's fixitfast.servicemagic.com.
One little fish oil pill. You know, this powerful little pill is great for your heart, that it's great for your joints. It even has powerful benefits for your skin and brain function. But the fish oils of today are sadly incomplete because they don't contain the super antioxidant power of clinically proven krill oil that can increase joint comfort by 28% in just 7 days. Until now. Introducing the free bottle giveaway of Krill Omega-3 from Purity Products, our most powerful fish oil formula ever. The only thing our advanced Krill Omega-3 fish oil is missing is the price. Because right now, we're offering anyone a full-size bottle of our krill oil as part of a nationwide free trial. Just call 1-800-950-5868. To request yours, you can't go to stores. The only way to get your free bottle is to go to the phone. The number is 1-800-950-5868. Call now and claim your bottle absolutely free. 1-800-950-5868. That's 1-800-950-5868.
This is your Travel Minute. If you're planning a flight for business or pleasure anytime soon, here's the 3-1-1 rule for carry-on luggage to ease your way through airport security lines. Rule 1. Only 3-ounce or smaller containers of liquid or gel are permitted in carry-on luggage. However, larger containers are permitted in your check-in baggage. 2. Place your 3-ounce or smaller containers into one 1-quart size clear plastic zip-top bag. Only one bag per traveler is allowed. 3. Place the bag into the security bin with your shoes and other items as required for scanning. The rules for other personal items vary, so it's a good idea to check with your airline or travel agent before you pack for your trip.
Your Travel Minute is a public service by this station and ASTA, the American Society of Travel Agents.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
Angelina is off. Just Peter Werby here with you. Our final segment, so if you've got some comments, let us know. 313-298-WRIF, 298-9743. I don't know. Letting you carry your gun into a bar. Well, They didn't Dodge City. That worked out okay. At 1 a.m., George LaPre. Actually, we're going to start with Christian Parenti, who's written Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. Then George LaPre, who's written Fragging, Why U.S. Officers, Why U.S. Soldiers, rather, Assaulted Their Officers in Vietnam. Kind of grim fare, isn't it? But a lot of other good things at my website, including information about both those books. Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, peterwerbe.com. What else is on my mind here? Oh, yeah. Thank you to Harold, who wrote into calltalkyes at yahoo.com. Maybe this is my fault. I have to check this out. He says, I live in a small apartment with cardboard walls. Can I ask your sound engineer, which is me, to adjust your settings? You come out at blasting volume, and your callers are coming in so low, I have to crank my stereo higher all the time. And it's starting to piss my neighbors off. Any help will be appreciated. Someone else either email me or the next caller. Tell me, is that happening? It shouldn't be like that. See, here is here's John in Farmington Hills. Hey, John, you're on the air. Welcome.
How you doing today?
Good, good.
You mentioned before that we had two choices usually, and I was thinking that if this is a democracy, we should have three choices if we want. We should be able to vote for more than just two options. And stuck in that two options,
yeah,
two parties, and you know that's there's so much apathy with the voters out there that they don't go to the polls. These other third world countries, these people line up for the whole day. You know, they get the day off to go vote, and I think that's where most people are losing control because they don't go use that vote, and there's going to be a lot of sheeple out there.
Well, I think that we have a situation where. People are apathetic for real reasons. They don't think much changes. I mean, I've had people say to me, I've had two people, very active Democrats who said, you know, I'm not even going to vote next year. And they said that I've just had it with Obama. I had someone tell me they can't stand the sound of his voice anymore. You know, here was somebody that just electrified the world. And he's so temporized and compromised. Now he's even talking about doing some of the things that that were looked for a while would have been the Democrats' ace in the hole. That is to defend Medicare and Social Security. Now he's saying, well, those will be on the table as well. What's up with that? So people just get discouraged. I mean, I'll tell you, I voted for Barack Obama. In a way, because I always vote for the lesser of the two evils. I didn't think he was. I mean, he said he was going to. We were in the wrong war. He said we're going to go into Afghanistan and do what has to be done. I mean, he never, contrary to these idiots saying he's a socialist and all of that, he's a real mainstream centrist. In fact, he's probably a center rightist in many ways. Just that, those guys in the right are so far right they make him look like a liberal.
Right. Well, I'm not sure Sarah Palin would be the, the best choice for a third party, but we need an option. I voted for Ross Perot.
Years ago.
We needed a change. We need a big change. When there's lobbyists there that can buy votes and the masses of people wouldn't vote for that just because they have the lobbyists and they're paying for their votes that they're getting them. That really cuts into, the way people vote and their options. And it was, like you mentioned earlier, and it was kind of ironic that the last section was about gun control that you had. That's one of the only reasons that we have a chance of keeping this a democracy is because we have the right to bear arms. Maybe that's why the revolution didn't start until 1776, because they weren't ready yet or they weren't prepared to fight yet.
Well, I doubt, as long as the armed forces remain intact, I don't think guns will play much of a role. I mean, they might. I mean, if you look at the best maybe couple examples, one is Libya, where, you have now everyone's armed, so you essentially just have a civil war. And in Syria, where although the resistance is nonviolent, it's certainly taken a lot of casualties. Yeah, I mean, one thing, I wasn't talking about gun control, but we just ought to realize that how many wacky people there are in this country that shouldn't have access to guns, and here you have the NRA trying to assure that they can get their hands on them. Or you got a guy saying it's okay to bring guns into bars. I mean, you know, if you have to bring a gun into a bar, you shouldn't be in that bar as far as I'm concerned. And the kind of people that would want to take a gun into like an ordinary bar, like all the bars that you and I are, that go into just to have a drink or to, you know, I mean, what in the hell would anybody want to bring a gun in there for? I mean, it's just insane. All right, John, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Hey, this is Don. Don, where are you calling from? You're on the air.
Gun in the bar.
Hey, Don.
You know, if you have to bring a gun into a bar.
Don.
Bar.
Donnie getting this. I'm gonna put Don on hold. He'll figure this out in just a little while. One of the things that's going on, we talk about mass movements. There's an article that said, what's the most expensive college, the least? And then you can find out that students and families can now compare college tuitions. There's a new website at the Department of Education. And a Senate report to be released Thursday, let me see, when was this? That's already been released, shows that community colleges, long seen as the affordable route to higher education, are increasingly unaffordable for American families. Get this. From 1999 to 2009, tuition at public two-year colleges increased 71%. Any of you going there, or if you had family members, you probably know this. While the median family income declined 5% adjusted for inflation, according to the National Center for Public Policy in Higher Education. Now, let me just go over that again. It used to be that the upper middle class and the wealthy, they would go to the University of Michigan and they would go to elite schools in the East and, you know, these kind of ritzy schools because they were preparing themselves for the role that their parents were in, right? The upper middle class, managerial classes, and then the upper classes, the owner classes. So they had to have the best, and there was also a good old boy network there, like we talk at Yale, like the old Skull and Bone Society and what have you, where they form these relationships that last throughout their economic life. So at least then they decided we needed an educated workforce for the managerial levels and some levels of skilled, kind of skill sets that were necessary in engineering and what have you. So, this was then a considerable step down. Now, I'm not saying this. I mean, I'm just saying this is the function within the economy. I think I have friends that teach at community colleges, and I think the world of them. However, now they've increasingly been priced out of the range of any number of families. And this is what I mean. This is an attack on the middle class. So you have somebody that wants to send somebody to Dearborn Community College, for instance, or Macomb Community College, something like that. In 10 years, the two-year colleges, the fees increased 71%. The median family income in the United States declines 5%. In the meantime, though, the ultra-rich get more and more money, you should realize. Corporate profits go. But so you're making, however you want to cut it, less money. They keep rising. The costs keep rising. Well, what has to happen, of course, is that you defer purchases of items in order to send your kid through college, or if you're paying for it, you do that. You scrape, and somebody was talking about how much, they had to work these days and all that. So you would think, doesn't anyone read the paper, watch the television other than me? I mean, there's examples. Someone said something about, they wanted me to pay more taxes. That was it, because they figured I was probably making $1 million a year. Let me say, if I was making $1 million a year, I would support higher taxes on me. If I was making $100,000 a year, I would do that. But anyway, in other countries, governments announce they're raising the tuition, and suddenly there's 1 million people out in the street. Yeah, they're saying, no, you're not doing this to us. You're not taking this money from us. Why don't you take it from the military budget or something like that? Why don't you tax the rich who can afford it? We're just working class or middle class people. You can't do this to us. And they fight back. Sometimes they're successful. Oftentimes they're not. But, I'm not into being a beautiful loser. But there is something stirring for the human soul to at least know that you have fought back and not said, remember I used that phrase earlier, it comes from a friend of mine's poem, please, sir, don't kill everything so fast. That that's a pretty weak demand. And just like, you know, with this debt limit things, Barack Obama should say no compromise. All of the debt reduction is coming from taxes on the rich, cutting the Pentagon budget, calling back hundreds and hundreds of bases from around the world, raising the payroll tax on the wealthy, all of this stuff like that. We're not cutting back any social expenditures. In fact, we're going to expand social expenditures. We're going to take that money that out of this swollen war budget that has no purpose whatsoever and start rebuilding the infrastructure of this country. We're going to start building new schools until we get only 13, 14, 15 kids in a class. Not, what were they talking about? Didn't it come up to 60 at one point? We don't even want 35 kids in a class. Or this country's going down the tubes. All right, let's talk to Don in St. Clair Shores. Don, hi.
Hey, what's going on?
Hi, turn your radio off, will you?
All right.
Okay, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter, what's going on?
How you doing? What's up? You're on the air.
All right. Basically, I think that shit's nuts. I mean, you really got to stop and think for a minute. What's going to happen the first time somebody takes a gun into a place and they just shoot the place up because they're way too late, didn't get into an argument? Who are we going to blame from this?
Well,
how can you look at this objectively and pick the logic out for the people that actually put this law into effect? What logic was behind this? I can't figure it out.
I don't think there's any logic. I think that it's political expediency, and at the root of it, using that phrase I used earlier, it's psychopathology. It's absolute nuts. I mean, you can, crime is actually at a low point in this society now. I mean, could start turning around because when you start having recession and depression, people start turning more and more to crime. But what do people imagine? They're going to be sitting in some nice bar in Troy or something like that, or Rochester, and, you got about 10 armed guys, and somebody's going to come in the middle, like 11 o'clock at night, and say, all right, just stick up. Everybody's, come on. I mean, that's insane. Absolutely insane. I agree with you, Don. All right, thank you very much. You know, there's the money, the gun nuts, but then there's also the money nuts. You know, they're really into gold, and everything has to be backed by gold, which is a total impossibility. But the number of dollar bills that are coming out of the government presses now have fallen to this modern low last year, that they have production of $5 bills has dropped to its lowest level in 30 years, and for the first time in that period, the Treasury Department did not print any $10 bills. I don't know about you, but the only cash I get is from the cash machine at the bank. I haven't been in a bank, I don't know, in a decade probably. Oh, yeah, maybe something about my mortgage or something like that. But, you know, to get money, I never do that. You go to the ATM, right? And you get 20s. I mean, at some point when you do stuff, you want change and all that. But it says in this article in the New York Times, the meaning is clear. The future is here. Cash is in decline. You can't use it for online purchases, nor on many airplanes even to buy snacks. 36% of taxi fares in New York last year were paid with plastic. And there is a bar restaurant in New York City in the West Village called Commerce. Says credit cards only, no cash, please. Isn't that strange? There's no definitive data on all this. Cash transactions are notoriously hard to track, in part because people use cash when they do not want to be tracked. The futurists, who have long predicted the end of paper money, also underestimated the rise of the $100 bill as one of America's most popular exports. This is so bizarre. Money is so odd. You know, people buy money, right? Whoa, what does that mean? The equivalent buys an equivalent. People say, well, gold, we want it in gold. Well, it's all a bubble. I mean, gold's going to, what is it, up to $1,500 an ounce or something like that? And people say, we can trust gold. We can really trust gold. If you had an ounce of gold worth $1,500 sitting there, or $1,500 in $100 bills, which would you take? I bet you everybody would take the cash, don't you think? This is Rob in Port Huron. Rob, hi, you're on the air. Rob, are,
hey,
you, the
how
guy
you,
that, are you the guy that just called?
Hey, no.
Oh, go ahead, because it's the same noise. Go ahead, you're on the air.
No. You know, I've been listening to everybody about carrying this gun into a bar, carrying a gun everywhere you go, and every single person keeps forgetting the basic point.
What?
You're not allowed to have a firearm and be drinking.
Right.
It's against the law. You go to jail for it.
No, I know.
You're going to tell me everybody sitting in the bar is going to be stone cold sober. I don't believe it.
I mean, it's kind of crazy.
I don't even know why people are talking about it. It's dumb. You can't even go deer hunting and drink a beer and shoot a gun. You can't do it.
Yeah, I don't get it. Either you're in heavy traffic or something, but I hear a big roar. No, your point is very well taken, Rob. Yeah, I don't get it. You know, one of the things, you want to make laws if there's some pressing need. And what could have been facing the legislature of Ohio and the Republican governor, who spends most of his time attacking, unions and workers, to see the need to allow people to bring a firearm into what you're very accurately saying, a place where you go to imbibe and you can't do it. I mean, they don't mix. They're lunatics. All right, Rob, thank you very much. What do we got for time? Just a little bit more. In fact, the $100 bill being America's most popular exports for two decades since the fall of the Soviet Union, demand has exploded for the $100 bill, which is hoarded like gold in unstable places. Last year, Treasury printed more $100 bills than dollar bills for the first time. There are now more than 7 billion pictures of Benjamin Franklin in circulation, and two-thirds, according to the Federal Reserve, are held by foreigners. American soldiers searching one of Saddam Hussein's palaces in 2003 found about $650 million in fresh $100 bills. And then the United States, Bush, was sending over with U.S. troops skids on these big cargo, military cargo ships, planes, $100 bills to pay people off. Oh, man, what are we going to do? We'll figure something out. We're pretty bright. We're taking it for a long time. We're eating it. But I got confidence. All right. Thanks a lot, Sarah and Athena. Thank you so much. We'll have a podcast of this show up by noon today. My website is Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Lots of good stuff there and links. And please join us on Facebook. Back next week.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
How old's the roof on your home? If it's over 15 years old, how much longer will it last before the leaks begin? Think about the damage. Then think about this. If it's time for a new roof, call Sears to get your roofing done right. And if you call Sears right now, you'll save $500. Just call 1-877-938-1414. Sears licensed fully insured contractors install a variety of shingles and styles that are built for long-lasting performance. And you'll save $500 if you call now. So call Sears for a free in-home consultation. 1-877-938-1414. Hurry. Offer ends soon. Not available in all states. Installation provided by Sears authorized licensed contractors. License information available upon request. So if you need a new roof, call Sears Roofing. Call right now and save $500. Call 1-877-938-1414. That's 1-877-938-1414. Sears.
Rates, policy forms, and availability vary by state. Did you know that life insurance rates are near record lows? If you own life insurance or are thinking of buying any, why spend more than you have to? I'm Byron Udell, founder of AccuQuote. Since 1986, we've helped hundreds of thousands of people just like you save a fortune on their life insurance. Here's how we do it. We monitor the products offered by dozens of the most well-respected brand-name life insurance companies you trust so that you get the lowest rates. For example, a healthy 40-year-old can buy $500,000 of 10-year level term for less than $21 a month. 20 and 30-year rates are also available. And don't forget to ask us about the new term life plans that guarantee your money back even if you don't die. Take 5 minutes and call AccuQuote for your free quote at 800-654-2075. Find out how much you can save on your life insurance. Call AccuQuote today at 800-654-2075. That's 800-654-2075.
Do you have a disability that prevents you from working? Then you may be entitled to collect thousands of dollars of Social Security benefits. If you've been medically disabled for at least 12 months and previously worked 5 of the last 10 years, you may qualify to receive thousands of dollars paid directly to you every month. Just call Disability Benefits Alliance at 1-877-941-8822. Disability Benefits Alliance can cut through government red tape and help you receive Social Security disability.
These days, people of all ages, including adults, can have a perfect smile. Thanks to today's technology, people with crooked teeth may no longer need to wear metal braces. One option many adults prefer is invisible braces. Instead of the typical metal bands or brackets that are cemented to teeth, these braces are clear plastic trays. Some advantages of invisible braces are they can be removed for eating and for brushing and flossing. They are practically invisible to see, and they are less irritating to gums than traditional braces. Keep in mind that invisible braces are only available for people who need minor corrective work. If you are considering braces and would like to learn more about invisible braces, speak with your dentist. You're never too old for a beautiful smile. For the ADA Dental Minute, I'm Dr. Maria Lopez Howell. For more information, visit our website at ada.org.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Everything that rocks.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. I was just listening to the old Loving Spoonful song, Hot Town Summer in the City. So, you know, it's hot and we expect that. And we also know, I think most of us, that there is great climate change. I think that kind of debate where people enthrall either to dark conspiratorial forces or energy companies are pretty much in the minority. We know that there's great climate change occurring. And I think a lot of us see it as, an inconvenience, a little warmer, maybe the weather's getting a little severe. I think if we think deeper about it, it has much greater implications for our future. But I think a lot of us never thought about the social and political consequences of climate change and global warming. Well, we're fortunate to have an author who has put together an incredibly challenging book. It's called Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. I suspect a lot of you never really connected those two things together. The author is Christian Parenti. He's a contributing editor at The Nation magazine, and this is published by The Nation magazine, by the way. He's a visiting scholar at the City University of New York, a senior fellow at Demos. He has a PhD in sociology from the London School of Economics and a long history of books and articles in a variety of publications from Fortune and New York Times. He's written Lockdown America, The Soft Cage, and also the Freedom. It's a pleasure to welcome Christian Parenti. Thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks for having me on your show, Peter.
Yeah, it was. What kind of tipped you to the idea that climate change could have created a new geography of violence, which is the subtitle of your Tropic of Chaos book?
Well, I think it came to me first when I was reporting in Afghanistan, and one of the stories I would always return to was the poppy economy, which is the flower from which opium comes and then heroin. And in Afghanistan, the Karzai government and the NATO forces eradicate poppy. They're against its production. The Taliban support it. And so I was asking these farmers, you know, why do you grow this high-risk crop that the government doesn't want you to grow? And they would say, well, you know, the drought makes it very hard, and poppy is very drought-resistant. And I didn't really at first realize there was a drought, but it turns out that Afghanistan has been in the grips of the worst drought in living memory during this whole nation-building project in Afghanistan. And poppy uses one-fifth the water that wheat requires. And so it's one of the only ways that Afghan farmers can adapt to this drought that they're living through. And the drought fits a pattern that climate scientists have predicted for decades now of increased drought punctuated by flooding and, you know, basically just off-kilter weather. And so it struck me that you know, along with all the ideological and religious motivations that a young man might have for joining the Taliban, there was this other material incentive that was linked to climate change, which is that the Taliban were defending the rights of the farmers to grow this illegal crop. And so I started thinking, like, okay, this is an important factor in contributing to the war because it helps, you know, explain this endless stream of young men to fight for, on the side of the Taliban. It's not the whole cause of the war. It's not the primary cause of the war, but it's an important factor. And it shows how climate change is exacerbating violent situations. I thought, I bet there are other examples of this around the world. And sure enough, there are. I mean, that's what the book is a tour of these hotspots and unpacking the climatological, environmental aspect to these various conflicts.
Well, I was going to say, in Tropic of Chaos, Christian Parenti, that you put together, you've really gone around the world, Brazil and Mexico, India and Pakistan, Afghanistan, as you said, Kenya. How does one go about as a writer saying, okay, I'm going to go here? I mean, you could have gone to, Kazakhstan and, Colombia. I mean, how did you get tipped to where would be fruitful areas for you to go when you were writing Tropic of Chaos?
Well, I kind of looked for the correlation between two things, violence and whether there was evidence of crazy weather, and then, you know, went to see what the connections were. And there was, once I started looking, you know, there were a lot of examples. I mean, as you mentioned, I mean, Africa is a clear example, East Africa and Kenya. That's where I begin the book because it's a very clear and simple example. Devastating drought that's been going on for almost a decade, worse than 60 years, punctuated only by freak flooding, you know, not during the rainy season, not when there should be rain, sudden massive floods, which just makes the drought worse ultimately after the water runs off. And there you have pastoralists fighting over water holes, fighting over cattle with machine guns. And the traditional pattern of cattle raiding has taken on a new form, and it's really become a form of low-intensity intercommunal conflict. And the Kenyan police go in there, the paramilitary police with helicopters, and have firefights with these cattle raiders. The Ugandan military crosses the border into Kenya and vice versa. The bus traffic gets assaulted by these cattle raiders, and the whole situation is sort of spinning out of control due to lack of government services, because the government has been cutting back in the name of radical free market economics. They've been withdrawing all their support for these pastoralists. The region is flooded with guns because of the Cold War, because both sides during the Cold War supported proxy forces, so now it's real easy and cheap to get an AK-47 and ammunition. And then the third and final factor is this devastating weather patterns that are developing of drought and flooding. And so you've got, you know, a real crisis of low-intensity conflict throughout East Africa that's linked to climate change. A clear example also is in Kyrgyzstan. I mean, it's not a country people in the U.S. really care about that much or whatever, but, you know, it's important, and it's indicative of trends elsewhere. So people might remember that last year, there was rioting in Kyrgyzstan. The capital was engulfed in flames, and the Uzbeks and the Kyrgyz were at each other's throats. And at first glance, it just looked like, oh, you know, ethnic hatred. But
now, that's what I was going to say. It just seemed probably just more ethnic madness. But this is why books like Tropic of Chaos by Christian Parenti, my guest, is so important, because it never occurred to me, and it should have, to look beneath the surface. Although, here's what's, I think, important about your book, Christian, is it didn't occur to me to look any deeper. What were the indications that got you to do it?
Well, it's basically, people have for years talked about, okay, climate change is going to stress society, and this could lead to violence. And so I'm just taking that assumption and moving it into the present. And I was like saying, well, you know, could or maybe does already. Let's check it out. And sure enough, it does. So, I mean, the Kyrgyz example, ethnic rioting. Well, what's the story there? Basically, the entire country gets its electricity, 90% of its electricity, from these old hydroelectric dams. They've been suffering a serious drought. They've had to ration power. On top of the rationed power comes the worst winter in living memory. Cattle herds die, pensioners are freezing to death. industry has to close down because there's not enough power, because there's no water in the dam, so they're rationing power, just as they need power because it's so cold. Then the government tries to privatize the power system and raises power rates 100%, and that causes people to protest. And then those protests, which are about, at one level, electricity prices and unemployment, turn into ethnic violence. But you see that beneath the ethnic violence is an economic crisis. Beneath the economic crisis is an environmental crisis, this drought and this brutal winter and the dependence on hydroelectric. And, you know, that could be the story of a lot of countries. I mean, there are countries all around the world that are operating with a very thin margin of error. I mean, Bolivia, there hasn't been war yet or anything, but, you know, people there are heavily dependent on glaciers that are melting. And then, you know, we have in the U.S., I mean, where your listeners are, the Midwest, we're not experiencing the impacts of climate change as violence, but we can see the crazy weather, the flooding.
Sure.
Last year and then this year, again, the Midwest is affected by flooding. That is having the effect of raising the price of grain exports, which in turn is fueling violence in places like the Middle East. I mean, one reason that there's war in Libya and Syria and Yemen is that the floods in the Midwest last year and the drought in the Black Sea region drove up the price of grain. Corn almost doubled. Wheat went up like 81%. In a country like Egypt, the average person spends 40% of their income on food. Well, last year, food inflation due to these weather events was running at 20%. Egypt is the largest single grain importer in the world. Russia banned wheat exports due to the drought. Lo and behold, the Arab Spring happens. There's movement towards democracy, but let's not forget there's also three wars associated with that. There's war in Libya, there's war in Yemen, and there's war in Syria as a result of that crisis, that beneath which is an economic crisis in part. There's also concerns about democracy and corruption and all that. But economics and food prices were part of what motivated those protests. And beneath that are these weather events that, you know, link back to the floods and the price of wheat coming out of the and corn coming out of the Midwest.
So
we're all connected here.
Absolutely. My guest on the Peter Werby Show, Christian Parenti, his book, Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence, is a Nation Books publication. You go to nationbooks.org. You can go to Christian Parenti's website, which is christianparenti.com. There'll be a link on my website, peterwerby.com, as well. Just a little footnote here. When you mentioned Bolivia dependent upon glaciers for their water supply, I think a necessity. You went over that quickly, but people should realize that that's their sole source of water, and those glaciers are melting rapidly. When they melt, they're not going to have any more water. Who knows what's in the world's going to happen then. Let's go back just a little bit. You mentioned Kenya and this dispute between pastoralists, herders, settling different quarrels and raiding with automatic weapons. But your book, Tropic of Chaos, begins with an individual act of murder, of violence, of one local man. What was this? Did this happen sequentially in your life, or was this something that you just focused on at the beginning of your book? I don't know if that's clear what I mean. In other words,
that was sort of where I began the research for the book.
Yeah.
I got the idea in Afghanistan, as I was explaining, but the first trip that I did just for the book was to Kenya, and I went up there into the Turkana region, and sure enough, you know, there's this constant raiding, and he had been killed the afternoon before, and I was, you know, there where this raid had been with the people who had been involved in fending off the raiders and just, you know, interviewing them about their lives and what this conflict was all about. And the guy was named Ekru Lorman, and he had been killed, and he was lying there, and the people who had killed him, the raiding party from the neighboring tribe, the Pokot, were still nearby. And, you know, I mean, that's par for the course now in northwest Kenya.
I remember a long time ago, listening to this LP, give you an idea how long ago it was, and the great poet and singer Gil Scott-Heron, in one of his little spoken word things, he said, America leads the world in expressing shock and doing nothing. Let's take the first part of that. Was what you witnessed shocking to you? I mean, you've been around the world, I know that, and you've seen a lot, which most of us have never and probably never will, but was much of this shocking to you?
Yeah, it's disturbing, definitely. I mean, like, you know, for example, in India, if you contemplate what's going on in India, I mean, India will soon be the most populous country in the world, more populated than China. And there's a war there, you know. There's a guerrilla war in India. We think of India as call centers where, you know, where your phone call gets routed for tech support when your Dell computer messes up or something. But in the countryside in India, the farmers, particularly in the east, are faced with very serious conditions, which are drought associated with climate change, plus a withdrawal of government support associated with this economic restructuring since the 1990s. They've embraced a kind of radical free market economics. And so there aren't the old programs of subsidized loans to small farmers and support in irrigation and all that. So the farmers are going deeper into debt in the face of the drought. They're losing their land. Thousands of them have committed suicide. But many others opt for political homicide, and they join the guerrillas. And if you look at the patterns of the Naxalite guerrillas, they've moved down the eastern side of India over the last 10 years, and they follow the drought. I mean, the drought precedes the guerrilla because the drought causes this economic chaos and suffering. And then the government's response hasn't been a program of economic development and social reform, but just counterinsurgency. And that involves, you know, seeding the area with more weapons and detaining and torturing people. I think ultimately, you know, breeding more violence. One of the crucial tools they use is they create paramilitary forces called the Salva Judum, who are basically, you know, potentially criminals. I mean, officially they're under the control of the Indian government, but, you know, they're private armies that are being created to fight the guerrillas. That's basically setting up that region for real calamity, social breakdown.
Well, you know, after World War II and through into the 1970s, the guerrilla movements that were launched were frequently communist revolutionaries or just or anti-colonial revolutionaries. What do these guerrillas in India want? I mean, what I can't even imagine what they could be asking for. Maybe, I don't know, the old call of...
They want a different civilization. I mean, they want a different society. They're, you know, they want an end to the inequality in India.
Oh, so they actually have a political program. This isn't just a spasm of violence.
Yeah, I mean, there are numerous guerrilla parties, and they're kind of uniting. They're of the Maoist tradition, coming in the tradition of the Chinese Revolution. And in different regions, they have different specific demands. But, yeah, they want revolution in India. I mean, they're clearly open to negotiation, and if there was a program of reform and redistribution, if the state put the private money lenders out of business and set up a public bank that didn't rip farmers off and help them adapt to the climate crisis, you know, I know that some elements in the guerrilla movements would embrace that. Some of the people I talked to, you know, they would be ready for a program of progressive social reform. But that's not how they're met. They're met with counterinsurgency and, you know, police raids and the establishment of these private armies.
Yeah, Christian Parenti, I asked you a little earlier if you were shocked by much of what you saw, and you used the word disturbing, which I suppose is pretty much interchangeable. I'm looking at the cover of your book, Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. And it has an extraordinarily disturbing photograph. And I'm sure that I probably have looked at it 15, 16 times and having it gone through my hands and all that. And maybe you could describe that and what relevance it has to what we're talking about.
Well, I mean, I didn't design it, so it's but it, you know, I think it just it shows the desperation. It's you know, a picture of people in a dump scavenging
garbage for survival. Yeah.
And that's the condition in this region, the Tropic of Chaos. You know, the global South, these countries along the equator that are suffering the worst impacts of climate change and also suffering the most acute political impacts of climate change. And that's the condition that a lot of people live in, and that's why people turn to violence. That's why people turn to crazy religious millenarianism, you know, follow religious leaders into war. That's why they turn on a different ethnic group. That's why they turn to banditry. That's why they fight their government. You know, that's why things fall apart, is because of inequality and poverty and desperation. And those things have existed for a long time, but they've gotten worse due to the Cold War, which used the Global South as its front lines, and the last 30 years of economic restructuring that has basically reduced public spending for, you know, support to small farmers, public provision of credit to small farmers and fishermen, and forced people to fall back on their own devices in the face of extreme weather. And frequently, the only devices at hand for people are these cheap weapons, and to turn on their neighbors or to turn against someone of a different religious faith.
You know, your book has a very, very nice endorsement on the cover from Mike Davis, the essayist who wrote Planet of Slums, which is probably one of the more depressing books that I've ever read. His essays about the future of cities and how the majority of people now in the world live in, I'm trying to remember them, for certain they live in cities, and whether the majority of people live in worldwide slums, I can't exactly remember. But he says a brilliant weather report from the near future of world politics. His book, Planet of Slums, I say, is just shows such a desperate future without any suggestions or indication how we could move out of this. How about in your book, Tropic of Chaos? Is there can we move off of this? I mean, we're concerned here in the United States. Gee, we're eating too much, and our waistline is expanding. Or can we get enough water on our lawn to keep it green even when it's 90 degrees in Detroit? That's not the concerns of the majority of people in the world, certainly not in a planet of slums.
No. I mean, in one place I saw a positive adaptation was in Brazil, where in the northeast of Brazil there is the same pattern of extreme drought punctuated by flooding. And farmers there are adapting what they call agroecological forestry, where they mix tree crops with vine crops and other crops, and to adapt to the dry environment and the extreme environment, and to use real low-tech forms of drip irrigation. And this methods are very effective, but they're labor-intensive, and they also don't require chemical inputs like fertilizers and pesticides. But they take a couple years to get up and running. So once the farmers have embraced this new ecological method of farming, they're free of moneylenders and they don't need as many capital inputs. But in this one community I was in, there was a movement called the MST, which is the Landless People's Movement in Brazil, and they struggle to, they use direct action, occupying unoccupied, you know, cattle ranches, unproductive land, to redistribute land, and they have managed to redistribute an enormous amount of land to hundreds of thousands of landless farmers in Brazil. So this village had on one side of the road, they owned the land, and they were using these agroecological forestry methods. On the other side of the road, they had occupied part of a cattle ranch owned by an absentee Italian rancher. And on that side of the road, they were using the standard method of farming of clearing the land, using pesticides. And I asked them why they weren't using the better methods, and they explained that they couldn't take the risk because they didn't own the land. They couldn't invest their labor as carefully into it, and they had to be essentially, you know, bad stewards of the land. And to me, that showed the importance of social justice in creating technological adaptation, that social justice and sort of technological adaptation are one and the same. Only when people have security are they going to treat the land properly. And that was what was on offer. I mean, that's what was explained clearly in the example. This one group of people with a land that they owned, they could care for, they could adapt to these extreme methods. The land that they didn't own, they were forced to go for short-term returns.
We have about just a minute and a half left, Christian Parenti. This may be too big a question. When Americans read about the United States putting out our tax dollars for like $1.5 billion electrification projects, say in Iraq or Afghanistan, we go, wait a minute, what about Michigan? What about our region? Is there a role that the United States can play? I mean, a lot of you talk about the weapon.
Yeah.
They've got our weapons, a lot of the people that are killing each other. But what could U.S. government policy do?
That's the question of mitigation, of cutting emissions. A place like Michigan would benefit greatly from that. If the U.S. really embraced developing a clean technology sector, the Midwest would stand to gain a lot of jobs and a whole new round of investment. And there's a lot that the U.S. government could do without passing new legislation or any of that. The main thing is the EPA has the power to regulate greenhouse gas emissions and needs to be encouraged to do so. It is not doing so robustly. It's grandfathering in lots of old, dirty sources of power. The other thing, the government, the federal government and state governments together constitute over a third of U.S. GDP. If government spending on vehicle purchases and power purchases for what are the largest fleet of vehicles and buildings in the country, if that money, which is going to be spent anyway, were spent buying clean technology that would help reduce, you know, electric cars, electricity from wind power, etc. That would help reduce carbon emissions directly, but indirectly it would also create economies of scale for the burgeoning clean tech sector, who are currently starving for customers and having a hard time providing their power and their vehicles at a cost competitive price point. And if the government purchased clean technology and clean power, that would drive down the price of these commodities, these technologies, to the point where the private sector would then be able to start adopting them because they were not more expensive and made more sense. So that's something that could happen right now without having to deal with the climate denialists in the House of Representatives who are never going to vote for any kind of new program of energy planning or whatever. That's just a matter of, you know, using the money that is going to be spent on vehicles and power anyway, using it correctly to help nurture a clean technology sector.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the broadcast. The book is Traffic of Chaos, and one of the things that it does is warns that this traffic, this band, could expand. Right now, maybe we don't feel it's hitting us too directly, but the subtitle, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence, it could happen here. So this is a terrific book to check out. Christian Parenti has been my guest. You can go to christianparenti.com. Also to my website, peterwerby.com, and there'll be a link to the book. Thanks so much for being on my show.
Thank you for having me on, Peter.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
What do you see yourself doing a few years from now? Thinking about a career is one thing, but preparing for a career is what really counts. If an education in information technology, electronics technology, or drafting and design could help you prepare, then check out the technology-focused programs offered at ITT Technical Institute. Call ITT Tech at 800-741-5123. At ITT Tech, you can develop knowledge and skills to pursue opportunities in a variety of career fields. Classes in day or evening courses meet just a few days a week, and financial aid's available for those who qualify. So if you want to prepare for a career involving technology, look to a leader in technology education. Get started by calling ITT Tech for more information. Call 800-741-5123. 800-741-5123. That's ITT Tech. 800-741-5123. For important information about these programs, go to programinfo.itt-tech.edu.
Are you ready to do something about your high credit card debt? Tired of paying double-digit interest rates, late fees, over-limit fees? It's time to stop the madness. Get out of debt the safe and affordable way with Credit Card Relief. With Credit Card Relief, there are no upfront fees, no monthly maintenance fees, and no settlement fees. You don't pay anything until a debt is settled, all with a 90-day money-back guarantee. That's credit card relief, managed by local attorneys in-state, with workout plans tailored to your debt situation. Get out of debt in months instead of years, all while saving thousands in future bank fees. Call the original credit card relief, where the consultation is free and the results are real.
Call 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. That's credit card relief. 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282.
These days, carrying a mortgage can overwhelm even the strongest person.
Don't I know that?
But there is a way to help ease your struggle, especially if you're facing foreclosure. One option may be advice from a certified foreclosure prevention specialist. It's absolutely free. Don't struggle. Learn more at www.makinghomeaffordable.gov. That's makinghomeaffordable.gov. Because foreclosure is not a foregone conclusion. A message from HUD in partnership with the National Fair Housing Alliance.
Is it time to replace your home's carpet or flooring? Call Sears Flooring to get shop-at-home convenience you can trust. Sears Flooring brings the showroom to you with a wide range of carpet, tile, hardwood, and laminate. And if you call right now, you'll save 20%. Call for a free in-home consultation at 1-888-491-3939. Sears Flooring has many styles to match your home and your budget. Your new flooring will be precisely installed, and your satisfaction is guaranteed. So call Sears Flooring right now and save 20%. Call 1-888-491-3939. Offer ends soon. Not available in all areas. Installation provided by Sears Authorized Licensed Contractors. License information available upon request. Call Sears Flooring. You'll save 20% if you call now. Call 1-888-491-3939. That's 1-888-491-3939. Sears.
One size does not fit all, especially when you're talking about your mortgage. Introducing the all-new Yourgage from Quicken Loans. Yourgage is better than a traditional mortgage because it conforms to your goals. In fact, it's the only home loan that allows you to custom design your term anywhere between 8 to 30 years. Here's how it works. Let's say you've got 8 years left on your mortgage and you want to refinance to a lower interest rate. The Quicken Loans 8-year fixed Yourgage can help. It keeps your term short and lowers your monthly payment. Just call Quicken Loans at 888-249-1425. The Quicken Loans Yourgage. It's a home loan on your terms. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. Nationwide licensing number 3030. Other restrictions apply. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. Call 888-249-1425. That's 888-249-1425.
The following contains a toll-free number for individuals looking to lose 30 pounds or more.
Please pay attention. If you would like to be among the first to try a weight loss supplement that's proven to help you lose weight, please call the toll-free number at the end of this ad. If you do, you will receive a risk-free trial of an exclusive weight loss aid that does not require a prescription. By enrolling in the 30-day risk-free trial, you'll be able to burn fat more quickly by boosting your metabolic heart rate, allowing you to lose weight in days instead of weeks. Be among the first to call and get your trial risk-free. 1-800-507-7923. Again, if you would like to try a proven weight loss supplement that could help you lose 30 pounds or more without a prescription, you may now call for the risk-free trial. Call Acai Fresh now. 1-800-507-7923. 1-800-507-7923. You may begin calling now. 1-800-507-7923.
Homeowners, how do you find the right contractor when you want something built? How do you find the best service professional when you need something fixed? For any type of service for your home, go to the most trusted website for pre-screened home pros. Just go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. Service Magic is a free online resource that instantly connects you with pre-screened remodelers, maids, repairmen, and many other home contractors. If you need a plumber, electrician, painter, or any other home pro, visit fixitfast.servicemagic.com. It's easy and it's free, and it's the smartest way to find neighbor-rated contractors in your area.
Over 10 million homeowners have trusted Service Magic for their home improvement and maintenance projects. So hire a pre-screened home pro with confidence. Go to fixitfast.servicemagic.com. fixitfast.servicemagic.com. That's fixitfast.servicemagic.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. This is a country, well, probably like most nations, that gives a special, how would you say it? Special thanks. I'm looking for better words than that. But a recognition of the military and oftentimes the sacrifices that they've made in defending the nation or defending freedom, as we often say about the United States. And in fact, how many holidays are there that revolve around military values? That we, 4th of July and Memorial Day, Veterans Day, and all often. Every politician will begin with thanking the active Army or veterans for what they often say is the sacrifice that they make. The one real bad time for the American military was during the Vietnam era. In fact, what the Vietnamese call the American War, which went on for almost as long as the Afghan War has been going on now. Things had deteriorated in the military towards the end of the 1960s and the beginning of the 1970s, that there was an extraordinary concern that the Army itself might collapse. There was instances of mutinies. Anti-war literature was circulating among active-duty GIs. Active-duty GIs led anti-war marches in the United States, in which contravened military rules. But probably the worst expression of problems within the military was an activity called fragging. F-R-A-G-G-I-N-G. And that was the attempted assault or actual assault and sometimes assassination of military officers. An incredible book detailing all of this has come my way. It's by George Lepre. It's called Fragging, Why U.S. Soldiers Assaulted Their Officers in Vietnam, and we're reaching him at his office in New Jersey. George Lepre, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you spent several years in the U.S. Army, and your biography says you're currently pursuing a graduate degree at the New School for Social Research. That's in New York City. But you were saying that your union work has kind of gotten in the way of seeking a degree. This is unusual. Usually people, when they write histories and when they're published, for instance, like this one is, by the university, by Texas Tech University, for their press, they usually want you to have big-time university credentials. What's the story here? Because you wrote another scholarly book called Himmler's Bosnian Division, which received the Sidney Zebel History Award from Rutgers there in New Jersey. So, in other words, you don't even have the so-called academic credentials, yet you're highly respected.
Well, as my PhD meanders along, when I get it, then I'll be, I don't know, maybe I'll be teaching at the university level.
Okay.
Jobs available.
Well, let's tell us a little. I just went over quickly what this fragging was all about. Where did your, you told me beforehand that you're not old enough to remember the era itself, and fragging itself didn't get a lot of big news in the publications or on television of the era. But what tipped you off to this was a somewhat widespread phenomena that the assault on officers?
Well, I've been reading books about the Vietnam War for many years, and the early texts that emerged in the 1970s and the 1980s, they mention fragging, and it might provide a short definition of it, but none of these works made any effort at an authoritative type examination. Some secondary sources, those suggest that fraggings were common occurrences, and, others say nothing at all about it. And whenever I would, read about it, I always wondered, well, how many cases were there? I look for specific incidents. And whenever I select historical topics, I usually it's because they pique my interest in some way, and I can't find enough sources about it to satisfy my curiosity. So at that point, it's off to the archives I go.
Mm-hmm. Tell us just a little about, quickly, your military history. You were in what branch of the service?
I was in the regular Army. Yeah. I had an 11 series MOS. I was an infantryman. And when I entered the military, it was in the 1980s. It was in an interesting time because, I mean, the Vietnam era was over, but a lot of the Vietnam guys were still in the military. And, you know, they were basically our bosses. They were the senior non-commissioned officers and the field grade officers on up. And so, you know, we'd ask them about Vietnam, the older guys, and they'd tell us some about it. But, you know, that's really what got me interested in it. You know, early reading about it when I was still in school. And then, of course, you know, meeting some of the guys when I entered the Army myself.
Did they ever mention fragging? I mean, when they were telling you these Vietnam...
No. They didn't mention the incidents themselves. That came from the literature.
Well, you said you wondered how prevalent it was. Was it? I mean, was it a phenomena that, or just something, you know, kind of below the surface that didn't have great manifestation? Most people probably are completely unaware of it. That's why your book, Fragging, is so intriguing.
Well, the absence of complete records that precludes any exact count of fragging incidents that occurred in Vietnam. The official Marine Corps history of the war, it estimates that there were about maybe between 100 and 150 incidents. The Army, they have statistics that are more complete, but their statistics include suicides, accidents that weren't felonious, and other cases that were found to be the result of enemy action. So, you know, there too, there's only an estimate. In the case of the Marines, I was able to confirm 94 incidents in which 15 Marines were killed. And in the case of the Army, my estimate is around 600 to 850 incidents.
Whoa.
With about 42 soldiers killed. And that doesn't include South Vietnamese nationals. They include, because there were fragging incidents aimed at them as well, and there were about 28 South Vietnamese who were killed in these cases.
Now, this is probably the difference. Tell me if you think I'm correct or not. Let me just reintroduce you and your book, though. My guest is George LaPrey. He's written Fragging, Why U.S. Soldiers Assaulted Their Officers in Vietnam. And if you're just joining us, fragging is the slang. The fact that often it was that fragmentation grenades were thrown into the tents of officers that were disliked for one reason or another. And we'll see if we can get to some of those reasons a little later. But as I was starting to say, the very high numbers of fragging incidents in the Army compared to that of the Marines, was that based on the fact that good numbers of the people in the Army were draftees?
Well, both the Marine Corps and the Army drafted during Vietnam. But I think this is a case of the fact that, I mean, for every Marine in Vietnam, there were about 8 soldiers. You know, Army strength in Vietnam was far larger than that of the Marine Corps. At its height, the Marines had 2 divisions, an air wing, and a logistics command over there. And their strength wasn't anywhere near that of the Army. So I think that might be just sheer numbers.
Okay. Well, you know, you have men with guns, young men, oftentimes, you know, with you're in these incredible, volatile situations and stressful and what have you. And this is true in any war. And I could imagine oftentimes that disputes, interpersonal disputes or dislike of people upwards of you in the hierarchy, one could settle it through force of arms. Is fragging unusual? In other words, did this happen in World War II and World War I and Civil War and all that? Or is this unique to Vietnam?
Well, when I was doing research on this book, I found that there were individual cases in other wars. In fact, I found that the first fragging incident, or what could be called fragging, occurred during the American Revolution. In fact, not too far from where I live in northern New Jersey, there was a mutiny at where the Army was camped in Morristown, New Jersey, and a captain was shot and killed in a Pennsylvania regiment. However, while these incidents did occur in other wars, they don't seem to have occurred with the frequency that they did in Vietnam. For example, I found a murder of an Army lieutenant that occurred in the Philippine Islands in 1906. And while he was commenting on the case, the judge advocate general of the Army said, in effect, fortunately, incidents like this are rare in the military service. I mean, if one were to look at Marine history, for example, you know, the Marines have fought in just about all the conflicts that the nation's been involved with. However, I don't think anyone's going to find a war in which there were 94 fragging incidents confirmed, and probably a number a little bit higher. So did they occur in other wars? Yes, but I don't think they occurred with the frequency that they occurred in Vietnam.
Did they begin to peak? I mean, did you trace when these assaults on officers began? Because frequently, having never been in combat myself, but everything I've read said that things get pretty local. Well, you're trying to stay alive, you're trying to keep your comrades alive, and the larger geopolitical goals pretty much diminish. But we were finally at a period that the anti-war sentiment, from everything I've read, within the army matched it of what was outside among the civilian population. So what did you get at all in the book Fragging about the motivation? Was it just settling personal scores, or was it people saying, wait a minute, this guy wants us to go out on some pretty dicey patrols and we ain't going, which I know happened quite a bit?
Well, there's, as far as motivation is concerned, what I did find surprised me regard to incidents involving combat operations, which is what you were just mentioning. There were incidents that occurred in infantry units in which, you know, one officer or NCO was considered to be overzealous in the way he conducted operations. However, when one looks at the records that are available, CID reports of investigation and studies, serious incident reports prepared by the Provost Marshal's office, I found that a lot of these incidents actually occurred in combat support and service support units.
Huh.
And there is where the personal disputes come in. A lot of times it would happen after an enlisted man was received disciplinary action against him. It usually came from the company commander in the form of non-judicial punishment. In other words, you know, the guy would get in trouble or something, and then he'd hold the officer or NCO responsible who was responsible for the disciplinary action being taken. As far as the anti-war movement, it's funny. Vietnam War literature, it seems to have fractured into two different schools of thought, whether, you know, anti-war sentiment played a role in fragging. On one side, the official military histories that are prepared by the armed services after the war and books that are written by retired officers, all they say is, well, the guys responsible for fragging is they were bad soldiers, they acted alone, there were aberrations in their units. On the other side, you have academics and some anti-war veterans who have gotten together, and they will go for a more conceptual approach. They say that, you know, the fraggings and desertions, the mutinies which you mentioned, that they owe to opposition to the war. And in my research, I find in a way that they're both right. I'm kind of in the middle. I didn't find any particular fragging case in which the established motive was, you know, we were going to harm, you know, Sergeant or Captain so-and-so because we opposed the Cambodian incursion or something like that. You know, there were soldiers in the ranks who did oppose the war. But what happened with them was they were more often draftees. They were older, they were better educated than the average regular Army soldier. But these guys, these anti-war soldiers, these more articulate men, their activities were centered on preparing and distributing the underground GI that emerged during the late 1960s. They were submitting congressional complaints. They were organizing Thanksgiving fasts and the like. These guys weren't the ones throwing the grenades.
You know, you actually, I don't know whether you got beeped or whatever, but you said they were preparing underground, I think your noun was newspapers?
Yes.
Yeah. People, I don't think, realize that there were how many anti-war newspapers circulated among the military at that time. I know I'm forgetting the ship, but there was at one point on one of these big aircraft carriers, there were two anti-war newspapers because these guys had gotten in a political dispute. So, as I said,
Kitty Hawk, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the Kitty Hawk, indeed. Yeah. And interestingly, I talked to a friend of mine who had been on there 2 years after the war was over. I said, "Did you ever hear anything about it?" He said, "Not a word." I said, "Well, I didn't think they were going to have that as part of the official history of the Kitty Hawk." George LaPre is my guest. The book is Fragging, Why U.S. Soldiers Assaulted Their Officers in Vietnam. It's published by Texas Tech University Press. You can go to ttupress.org, and also you can get the book through fragginginvietnam.com. I'll have a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com as well. And, George, you said you had a lot of documents at fragginginvietnam.com?
Yes, they're in the resources section. I placed several serious incident reports and court-martial transcripts there from a number of the cases. Anyone with particular questions, they can reach me through the site. I'll be happy to answer them if I can.
Okay, and, well, you mentioned court-martial proceedings. How were these cases resolved? Were the majority of perpetrators caught and court-martialed, or was the chaos of the battlefield such that you could get away with it?
Well, most of the men who committed fragging incidents in Vietnam were not apprehended.
Huh.
And the reason for that isn't so much chaos, but it's the fact that, you know, the limited evidentiary value that's left behind to crime scenes by grenades. You know, when someone throws a grenade, all they have to do is hide the little spoon that comes off of it, and there's no way to get fingerprints or anything off of it. They were usually committed late at night when there was a limited activity on the fire bases and encampments. And so I interviewed several CID agents, and they said that these cases were difficult to solve. What happened was in those cases in which men were apprehended, they faced military courts-martial, usually general courts-martial. Those are kind of like felony trials. And they faced charges of either murder, attempted murder, or aggravated assault. And like I said, 71 men who were convicted of these cases, 54 soldiers and 17 Marines.
Were you able to talk to any of those? Did you talk to them?
I found a collection of letters that one of them was later a Marine who was convicted of murder was transferred, like a number of them were, to federal prisons, you know, from the military stockades and brigs to a federal prison. I have a collection of letters that he sent to a Quaker volunteer. I sent letters to about three or four of them that I managed to find, and none of them responded.
Huh.
They wanted to put it behind them. They don't want to have anything to do with it.
And certainly not to anyone that committed a fragging and did not get caught. That would have been pretty interesting. But didn't I read in Fragging, your book, George LaPre, that there was actually a congressional law that extended the statute of limitations on this?
Well, it's what they did was originally, yes. What had happened was when the military justice system that's being used right now, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the UCMJ, when that was implemented in the early 1950s, there was a provision in that body of law that said that anyone who was discharged from the military but who had committed a serious offense while in uniform, you know, overseas where jurisdiction was an issue, they could be tried in military courts. However, what happened was in the mid-1950s, the Toth versus Quarles decision was made by the Supreme Court. That was a case in which an Air Force veteran who had, was accused of committing a murder in Korea, the Air Force police, they arrested him at his job in Pennsylvania, and they were going to drag him back to Korea to face a court-martial. However, his sister submitted a writ of habeas corpus, and the case eventually made its way to the Supreme Court. And their opinion was that once a person leaves the military, once they stop being an active duty serviceman and become that they cannot be tried before a military court-martial. They felt that since the person is a civilian, that they deserve more due process, the due process that's found in a civil court rather than before a military court-martial. So what they did was that prevented the military from trying veterans who had committed serious offenses outside of U.S. territorial jurisdiction. So those guys who'd committed crimes in Vietnam, whether it was fraggings against, you know, other Americans or, you know, violent crimes against South Vietnamese nationals, once they left the military, they couldn't be tried for it. And that made it, that reared its head during the My Lai case, because there were a number of men who were involved in that incident who had left the military, and they couldn't be tried.
Hmm.
And that went on until 2000, when the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act, MAJA, was passed. Now, today, if a serviceman commits a serious crime, is discharged, a serious crime overseas, I should say, and they're discharged in the military, they can be tried in a federal district court. And that's been tried once. There was a fellow who committed he killed several Iraqi nationals, and he was discharged from the military, and he was tried in a civil court, and he received a stiff sentence.
You know, most military histories are pretty grand and glorious, and particularly when they're celebrated publicly, because nobody wants to talk about kind of the warts, and certainly fragging is a wart. Your first book was Himmler's Bosnian Division, and that probably would get a lot of people scratching their head. It certainly is intriguing to me, but it's nothing that people know real well, and neither is fragging. What propels you in terms of seeking out sort of obscure, although extraordinarily interesting, in the case of fragging, I think very important, military incidents?
Well, it's like I said, whenever I read a grand narrative, as they used to call them, about some topic, whether it's a war or something, and I find that there's some sort of, area within that body of literature or that book or that war that deserves closer historical attention, especially one that's shrouded in myth, that's when I get going and I'll start writing a monograph about it. That's always been my way. I'll find some little thing that's unexplored and that people wonder about, but no one has ever really touched, and something that's, new and fresh, and that's what I go for.
And I think things that are interesting in and of themselves are important, but generally historical events, particularly when they're ones that involve us, Americans, and in this case the American military, they also have teaching aspects to it, or that we can learn something from it, or can we? We've had other wars since, other wars before, and there hasn't been any extensive fragging, as you've told us, and so is there anything to be learned from here, or is it something that we ought to just kind of a general lesson that I think everyone's learned from Vietnam? Don't do it. Although, are we doing it again in Afghanistan, which is another question. So, and let me just make it simpler: is there anything that can be learned from this, or should we just know the whole scope of the Vietnam War?
Well, it's with regard to fragging, I could say that whenever the military has difficulty in procuring new men, like it did during the later years of the Vietnam War, the military had to drop its standards and it had to accept people into the ranks who normally they would not have accepted. This even took an official form when Project 100,000 was instituted in 1966. But whenever the military is hurting for people and they have to lower enlistment standards to take people in to meet their recruiting quotas, there might be trouble. One thing to watch is when you have people who join, they volunteer at very young ages, and not because they're volunteering out of patriotism or anything like that. It's when they're volunteering to get away from situations at home that they're unable to resolve. And when someone like that joins, who's a high school dropout, who joins, to get away from home rather than to, serve their country, that's usually who are, among the offenders.
I think that happened in the middle part of the last decade in Iraq, when you had some of these horrendous crimes that were committed by very young GIs that were just, saw the whole population. Very similarly to Vietnam, where a whole population arrayed against them and just took out their frustration and their deep-seated dislike of the whole process against their officers in Iraq, but against the nationals. And fortunately, it hasn't been very extensive. Yeah.
Another thing that was done that was smart with Iraq and Afghanistan that was not done in Vietnam was that the reserves and National Guard were called up and sent over there. Now, I remember when I was in the regular army, we sort of looked down our noses at the National Guard, the weekend warriors, that they were older and that they had, they were all thick in the middle. But what happens is from the standpoint of good order and discipline, the National Guard and reserves, those men they tend to be older, but they also tend to be more mature. They have jobs and families to return to back home, whereas a 17 or 18 year old who joins to get away from home, that's a different kettle of fish altogether, and those were most of the offenders in the case of fragging.
Well, I want to thank you so much, both for the book and for spending the time with it. The book is Fragging, Why U.S. Soldiers Assaulted Their Officers in Vietnam. The author is George LePre, has been my guest. And Roy Millam, who is the author of Not a Gentleman's War, An Inside View of Junior Officers in the Vietnam War, says one of those myth-busting books. It debunks orthodox literature that fragging occurred on the battlefield rather than in the rear echelon, and we talked some about that. It's available from Texas Tech University Press, that's ttupress.org, but also through fraggingInVietnam.com. If you're missing any of that, you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. George LePre, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Rates, policy forms, and availability vary by state. Did you know that life insurance rates are near record lows? If you own life insurance or are thinking of buying any, why spend more than you have to? I'm Byron Udell, founder of AccuQuote. Since 1986, we've helped hundreds of thousands of people just like you save a fortune on their life insurance. Here's how we do it. We monitor the products offered by dozens of the most well-respected brand-name life insurance companies you trust so that you get the lowest rates. For example, a healthy 40-year-old can buy $500,000 of 10-year level term for less than $21 a month. 20 and 30-year rates are also available. And don't forget to ask us about the new term life plans that guarantee your money back even if you don't die. Take 5 minutes and call AccuQuote for your free quote at 800-654-2075. Find out how much you can save on your life insurance. Call AccuQuote today at 800-654-2075. That's 800-654-2075.
Right now, homes are more affordable than they've been in decades. And Quicken Loans has a mortgage program that will help you buy that perfect home. Call Quicken Loans right now. They can even introduce you to a local real estate agent that can guide you through the process step by step. With more than 25 years of helping American homeowners, Quicken Loans makes the process as easy as possible. With a streamlined approach and proactive updates, they provide you with the certainty you need to search for the home of your dreams. And highly trained Quicken Loan specialists are standing by, ready to help you take advantage of this incredible mortgage opportunity. So give Quicken Loans a call now. Call 888-249-1425. Find out how much home you can afford. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. Nationwide licensing number 3030. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. Call 888-249-1425. That's 888-249-1425.
This is Dan Tullis, and I just called
Joel Clark,
one of Select Quote Insurance Services Term Life Agents.
Hi, Mr. Tullis.
Joel, how does Select Quote save you money on term life insurance?
Well, buying term life insurance is all about choosing the right company. Let's say you take antidepressants or you smoke. All insurance companies are going to price that differently. We'll impartially shop all the companies we represent to find you the best price.
Can you give me an example?
Sure. I just got a man, 40 years old, who takes blood pressure medication. A $500,000 policy with a highly rated insurance company is priced $21 a month.
Call 1-800-928-6929 and see how affordable term life insurance can be. That's 1-800-928-6929. 1-800-928-6929. Or go to selectquote.com. We shop, you save. Get full details on the example policy at selectquote.com/commercials. Your price could vary depending on your health, issuing company, and other factors. Not available in all states.
101 WRIF.
What's up, everybody? This is Sully from Godsmack.
Hello, Motor City. This is Mike DeCree, Pearl Jam.
Hello, Motor City. This is Jimmy Page from Led Zeppelin. Your radio is locked on 101 WRIF. If it rocks, it's on the roof.
Everything rocks.
When it's raining hard outside, can your roof still keep out the leaks inside? If it's time for a new roof, get your roofing installed the right way with Sears. Call Sears for a free in-home consultation at 1-877-938-1414. You can save $500 if you call right now. Sears licensed fully insured contractors can get your roofing job done right. Sears has a variety of shingles and styles that are built for long-lasting performance, and you'll save $500 if you call now. So, for roofing done right, call